Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
No, I know why you're excited, because it's Super Bowl weekend. Don't pretend it's about me. That's right. Finally we can put aside politics and just enjoy Peyton Manning versus Cam Newton. Yeah! Who are you gonna root for? The old white guy or the fresh young black? Oh, it is like politics.
There's very little that's understated about Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton. At 6'5", 245 pounds, he has the athleticism of both a quarterback and a linebacker. He's known for his elaborate celebration dances and his wild fashion off the field. And he has good reason to be confident. He's a top contender to be this season's most valuable player. On Sunday, he will be one of only a handful of African-American quarterbacks to start in the Super Bowl. Yet his flashiness has been met with criticism. He's been called arrogant, a bad role model, and it's led some to wonder whether the harsh reaction is actually about his race. At a press conference Wednesday, Newton touched on the subject.
You know, I'm an African-American quarterback that may scare a lot of people because they haven't seen nothing that they can compare me to.
We've got Washington Post sports columnist Kevin Blackistone on the line to talk with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, how true is that we have never seen anything like Cam Newton?
Well, I don't think we've ever seen anything like Cam Newton in the sense of this time and era. A black athlete who is not fearful of talking about race and how he believes he's been perceived. You know, he kind of represents, I think, the urban black male almost that you see in the hashtag Black Lives Matters movement. Mm-hmm. You look at the commercial that he has now, in which he has a rap song by the rapper 2 Chainz in the background, and he's flexing. So I think in that sense, he's right. And there may be some people, and we know there are some people, who've been uncomfortable with his style of histrionics on the field. But there's been a long history of, I think, misinterpreting the actions of black athletes on the field in a way that no other athletes have to suffer.
Of course, no other athletes, but you have to add into this the quarterback, because there has been historically a stereotype of a quarterback. Just briefly, what would that be that he is not, perhaps, to some people?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been a suggestion over the years that because the quarterback position is the leadership role, the CEO role on the field for football teams, that they have to look and perform in a certain way. And in fact, a former colleague of mine wrote about this a few years ago when he was dismayed at how Colin Kaepernick, quarterback for the 49ers, looked with all of his tattoos. Well, that image we thought we had imploded over the years by the success of black quarterbacks over time, but apparently it hasn't. And so you see what happened to Cam Newton just this year, where a white mother from Tennessee, who was at one of his games, publicly criticized his histrionics and called him egotistical and a poor role model. And then even later this year, When Cam Newton announced that he and his longtime girlfriend had had a baby, there were letters to the editor in Charlotte which criticized his birth for being out of wedlock and for somehow suggesting that he was a poor role model in America that was leading to its decay.
Well, Kevin, we're going to have to leave it at that and more to talk about on this one. But Washington Post sports columnist Kevin Blackestone, thank you.
Thank you.
If you didn't watch last night's show, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, you missed out. The first installment of the miniseries on FX about the trial of last century started off with a super bang and promises to deliver on many fronts if all the episodes equal the opener. At first, I was worried that this project might bastardize a genuinely fascinating American crime drama, but nope, it is amazing. While many people will never be able to forget certain details of the case, it's easy to forget just how much this situation consumed the nation. Nearly every single person involved from the trial to those who covered it ended up as famous people. It basically invented the modern concept of reality TV. But what will be interesting to see is if in the end, this film changes anybody's mind about what actually happened. The verdict polarized the country and is still considered one of the most controversial rulings of all time. We'll see if a movie can heal that decades later. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
Well, I bet you you can't pretend there's nothing there.
WDRB has just uncovered hundreds of documents that detail allegations of racism, sexual text messages, and abusive power surrounding Shepherdsville's mayor.
In a story you'll only see on WDRB, Valerie Chin reveals the claims against Scott Ellis, why charges against him were dropped, and gets reaction from the mayor himself.
Binders of text messages and nude photos in this box at the Bullitt County Sheriff's Office. Photos of an alleged victim in men's private areas. Pictures so graphic they had to be blurred. WDRB has all the documents from the now-closed solicitation to prostitution case of Shepherdsville Mayor Scott Ellis.
But was he sexting with her?
Based upon the what I know of the term sexting and based on what I've read, I would say there's a guarantee that he was, yes.
In the nearly 600 pages of evidence, documents say Ellis admitted in a video confession that he used his position as mayor to get sexual favors from a woman on parole. The sheriff's office says that video is still in the hands of another agency that is investigating Ellis. Ellis is also accused of using racial slurs numerous times.
Nigga!
A Shepherdsville officer, who is now the assistant police chief, claims Mayor Ellis referred to black people with the N-word in 2012 and said, quote, every one of them should be injected with sickle cell so they could not reproduce. The document says two others witnessed Ellis saying that. One of those witnesses did not want to comment to WDRB, but the other, the Shepherdsville police chief, says he doesn't ever recall hearing Ellis use the N-word. We decided to get answers for ourselves and went to City Hall.
I'm Valerie Chin with WDRB News. I'm here to see Mayor Scott Ellis. A Shepherdsville police officer says that you've been using racial slurs, using the N-word.
No, I do not use those words. No, no, do not use those words.
I know that one of the employees that works at Shepherdsville had informed the investigator that Ellis made some racial comments regarding ethnicity and made some comments about that they caused a crime and some other comments about them that are unfortunate that he made those kind of comments.
In July, Ellis was indicted for solicitation to prostitution, a misdemeanor. But in November, Special Prosecutor Mark Schaus told WDRB that he read each of these text messages in the case file and did not believe the evidence supported the prostitution charge, so the case was dismissed. In late 2014, the Sheriff's Office says three women, including the parolee, came forward with sexual allegations involving Ellis, alleging Ellis made promises for sexual favors.
Is that you? It says your name on there.
Yeah, but I don't recognize him.
So what do you say about this then?
I don't have anything to say. This is the first time I've seen him. I don't recognize him.
In this message dated October of 2014 on Facebook Messenger to the parolee, Ellis says, "What I meant by you need something and I need something, you needed money for your phone and I needed a sexual favor."
To me, that's the biggest concern, is that government offices were used for that.
In this message, the alleged victim asked Ellis to get her a pardon from the governor. He says in the message, "I called and talked. Now it's in the governor's hands. I have called several times, actually."
Are you planning to resign?
No, absolutely not. I have no reason to.
Earlier, you had mentioned you were going to resign.
Well, we had talked about that, but I have no reason to.
What do you want to say to folks here in Shepherdsville?
You know, we have a lot of great things going on in this community right now. We have a road project that the governor just announced.
But how do you move past this?
We're moving past it. It's over. It's done. We're moving past it.
When you're a public official or you're put in that capacity where you're here to protect the public and you actually cause harm to the public, and unfortunately, my personal opinion, I think that's what's been done here.
Last week, Shepherdsville Treasurer Gayla Bright wrote this letter to the mayor and city council members saying she opposes the mayor's inappropriate behavior with female employees. She says she suffered mental abuse and Ellis retaliated against her for cooperating with the police investigation.
She makes a lot of allegations.
It's an out. We're not even going to discuss it. Okay. We're not going to discuss it. Have a wonderful day.
WDRB.com reporter Jason Riley goes in depth on the story and reveals what other text messages say. You can read the story right now on our website. In Shepherdsville, Valerie Chin, WDRB News.
Black babies cost less.
The first moments after the birth of a child are often the most intense of a mother's life. There's joy, but there can also be pain, exhaustion, and confusion. It was in this vulnerable time that 10 women in Los Angeles say hospital officials forced or deceived them into getting sterilized, and they sued them for it. The new documentary, No Más Bebés, examines their story. It premieres tomorrow night on PBS. From NPR's Code Switch team, Shireen Marisol Meraji has more.
After an emergency C-section at L.A. County Hospital, Consuelo Hermosillo got some unexpected news.
The doctor walked in and said, "Everything went fine." And I said, "Well, doctor, what am I going to use? Am I going to use birth control?" He goes, "No, you don't need anything. We cut your tubes." And I said, "Why?" He goes, "Well, you signed for it." I said, "Me?"
In No Más Bebés, Hermosillo recalls the doctor's visit that took place after she gave birth to her third child. She was in her early 20s, and it was September of 1973. 2 years later, Hermosillo took part in a class action lawsuit with 9 other women who all claimed they were sterilized without their informed consent at L.A. County Hospital. All 10 plaintiffs were Mexican immigrants and poor or working class, and they had similar stories. They had emergency C-sections, were given medication for excruciating labor pain, and they say they couldn't remember signing a consent form, they were confused about what they were signing, or they were coerced into signing. Most spoke very little English.
Era en inglés. Me dijo, tienes que firmar este papel, pero ya.
At 23 years old, Melvina Hernandez was rushed into a C-section at L.A. County Hospital because her baby was breached. She says a nurse told her, in English, that she needed to sign this paper, now. Hernandez wanted to wait for her husband, but the nurse told her if she didn't sign, they couldn't operate, and she'd die. Hernandez says the nurse grabbed her hand and signed the paper for her. 4 years later, she found out it was for a tubal ligation. Consuelo Hermosillo says she spent years trying to understand why this happened to them.
Were they doing it for not supporting these kids in the future, or were they getting money at the hospital for doing more sterilization? I always kept those questions in me. I never get those answers.
Two women set out to find those answers in No Más Bebés.
I'm Renee Tajima Pena. I'm a filmmaker and the director and co-producer of the film.
I'm Virginia Espino. I'm a historian and co-producer of the film.
Espino and Tajima Pena are L.A. natives, neighbors, longtime friends and colleagues. Espino learned about the sterilizations in graduate school studying Chicana history.
I grew up in Northeast Los Angeles, very close to the LA County Hospital. So I was real shocked to hear that women were being sterilized there in the 1970s, a time when I was coming of age.
So horrified by the story, she devoted her studies to tracing the history behind it and would talk about it with Tajima Pena when they were both new moms.
I was in baby bliss and I thought, oh, this is so profound. And it's all those cliches you think about motherhood. And she told me about these women, you know, who were sterilized without their consent, against their will. And I was floored.
About a decade after those initial conversations, the two started production on No Más Bebés. That meant finding the plaintiffs and defendants, all of whom hadn't spoken about the case publicly in 35 years. Tajima Pena said those willing to talk, both the women who were sterilized and the doctors who performed the sterilizations, all men, echoed their court testimony. The women still claim they never gave informed consent, and the doctors, like Jerry Newman, still maintain their innocence.
I knew personally I had not done anything. I could not, for the life of me, think of any of my colleagues who would have deliberately done this. We busted our in order to provide care for a lot of people and got sued for it.
The easiest thing to do was make a film about the good guys and the bad guys, the heroes and the villains.
Tajima Pena says No Más Bebés goes beyond that simple narrative. She says the answers to plaintiff Consuelo Hermosillo's questions are complicated. In 1970, Congress allocated millions for family planning. The money went to training, contraceptives, and sterilizations. At the same time, mainstream white feminists were calling for sterilization on demand, while another popular movement, the zero population movement, supported sterilization as a way to combat overpopulation, which they claimed was destroying the planet. And that's not all.
You have attitudes about immigrants, hostility towards immigrants, this fear that poor women, working class women are going to be having children and going on welfare. You have these cultural differences. You have all these things going on. And as a filmmaker, you kind of have to dig deeper beneath the surface and kind of look at those complexities.
For co-producer and historian Virginia Espino, it was important to provide as much historical context as possible,
so that everybody's thinking critically about it and coming to their own conclusions about what does that really mean when you talk about reproductive justice, reproductive rights, reproductive choice.
Espino says we talk a lot about the choice not to have kids, but what about the choice to have them? Consuelo Hermosillo says that decision was taken away from her. In one of the film's final scenes, Hermosillo is giving her baby granddaughter a bottle and reflecting on her hopes for the future.
I want her to have liberty on doing what she wants, going to school wherever she wants, decides how many kids she wants.
The filmmakers say No Más Bebés documents a history that continues to repeat itself. They point to the nearly 150 women sterilized in California prisons between 2006 and 2010 as a recent example. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR.
Here's an article that I came across since, you know, a lot of things in the news are talking about gender manipulation. It says surgery could give men wounds of their own within 5 years. So within 5 years, they're going to be able to transplant uterus in men and allow them to have babies.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii, And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
But we start this podcast in Britain, where scientists have been given the go-ahead to genetically modify human embryos for the first time. Our science correspondent, James Gallagher, has been explaining this controversial decision to Noel McGovern.
When an egg is fertilised with a sperm, over the next 7 days, it divides and transforms rapidly from going from a single cell to about 200 cells. It forms a nice sphere with a hollow sac in the middle and some specialised cells which are going to have very important roles in the future. But what no one really understands is how that happens. What goes on in order to get it from a single cell to this blastocyst stage that we're talking about? That's what the scientists want to explore, and the way they want to do it is to alter the DNA inside a fertilized egg in order to see what happens in the future. So basically, our DNA is the code of life, the instructions for building a human body, our blueprint of life. I'm sure we've heard all these phrases before. So what they're going to do is they're going to change it. And the reason that this is quite significant is that ultimately the concern or the promise of this research is that, well, what if you were to make changes to someone's DNA and then implant that embryo and result in a genetically modified child? That's why there is controversy around this field.
Just before we came on air, there was a line that critics are saying that it crosses ethical lines. But you mentioned that they want to understand how this process happens. But is it to eliminate diseases eventually? Like, what's behind it?
This is about fundamental biology,
just really
understanding what's going on. The potential implications of that are in terms of improving IVF, because if you know what should be happening, then you can start to improve IVF, possibly to eliminate miscarriage in the future is the other thing that they're trying to do out of this research. But at the moment, they're not trying to treat disease. It's about fundamentally understanding what happens after an egg is fertilized.
One other part to this is that these modified embryos cannot be put into a woman.
Exactly. They can't be allowed to develop past 14 days, according to UK law, and they can't be put inside a woman. That would also be completely illegal. Now, this isn't going to be a world first, though. It's worth noting that last year, China genetically modified human embryos, and that was about disease. So what they did there was they altered bits of the DNA that would have led to that embryo developing a blood disorder. So they were able to correct that defect. Now, they didn't implant those embryos either. But while we are going to talk about and have done about how this is a quest of pure biological discovery, always remember what's knocking on the door. The future implications for society of this are off the charts.
BBC science correspondent James Gallagher.
It's All Things Considered on WNYC. I'm Jamie Floyd. The defense is presenting its case in the manslaughter trial of Peter Leung. He's the rookie NYPD officer who shot and killed 28-year-old Akai Gurley in a housing project stairwell back in November 2014. WNYC's Robert Lewis has been covering the trial, and he was there today for the intense cross-examination of a key prosecution witness. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Jamie.
So on Tuesday, the prosecution ended the day by questioning Officer Leung's partner, Sean Landau. It's kind of confusing because he's a police officer, but he's being cross-examined. After a day off, Landau was back on the stand today for a second day of cross by the defense, What happened?
For starters, the defense really tried to attack the timeline. On Tuesday, Officer Landau gave dramatic testimony about how he and Leung argued for 4 minutes after the shooting about who should call their boss, with one saying, you call, and the other saying, no, you call. But the defense showed that shortly after the shooting, Officer Landau gave statements to internal NYPD investigators saying that he and Leung argued for only about 30 seconds. And he gave another statement a short time after that where he said that they argued for a little more than a minute. Then, of course, now it grew to 4 minutes. Defense attorney Robert Brown sort of mocked that amount of time, asking if they repeated, you call, no, you call, like 50 times. Landau said no, probably only a couple times, to which Brown countered, and that took you 2 minutes.
Okay, so are these kinds of details or inconsistencies really going to hurt the prosecution's case?
Well, I know it seems small, but remember, prosecutors presented this narrative of Leung after the shooting as worried only about himself, arguing with his partner and whining about getting fired for precious minutes while Gurley bled to death in the stairwell. But the defense is trying to show the event was chaotic and fast-moving and counter the story of Leung as worried only about himself.
And there were some other inconsistencies, too. How did Landau hold up overall under cross-examination? Because that's the key.
He was a shaky witness. He repeatedly contradicted himself in his prior statements, and the defense kind of shredded him. For example, Landau testified that almost immediately after Leung fired the shot, he said, I'm fired, meaning he was worried about his job and not the fact a man might be shot and dying. But the defense showed Landau was interviewed by NYPD investigators the morning after the shooting and told them he didn't remember Leung saying anything like that. So on cross-examination, defense attorney Brown says, so you're saying your memory got better over time? And Landau said, yes.
And he's a rookie cop. He's not used to testifying. What about the key issue of whether Leung called for an ambulance?
Well, Landau also testified this week that Leung didn't call for an ambulance. Leung is charged with official misconduct because of that. But again, the defense showed Landau made statements right after the shooting contradicting that. On redirect, prosecutor Mark Fleedner tried to contain any of the damage Landau's testimony did to the DA's case. At one point, Fleedner got sort of red-faced and started grilling Landau, which prompted the defense to object that prosecutors were effectively cross-examining their own witness. The judge sustained the objection and put an end to the questioning.
Okay. Officer Leung is charged with a second count of official misconduct. There's not calling the ambulance, but there's also not performing CPR or rendering aid to Gurley. And Officer Landau was also there. Why didn't he try to help?
Landau testified that he didn't feel qualified giving CPR. He said they only practiced on a dummy at the academy for a couple minutes. The defense asked if he would be concerned trying to do chest compressions on someone shot in the chest, as Gurley was, and he said yes. Asked if he felt less qualified to do CPR than Gurley's 99-pound weeping girlfriend, he again said yes. And I'd add, another officer who went through the academy at the same time as Leung also testified that he was taught CPR at the academy in a class with about 300 other recruits and only about 8 practice dummies. That officer never got to actually use one of the dummies because they ran out of time.
And no indication that either of these officers helped Gurley.
Well, neither gave CPR. Landau did testify that he did see Leung get down and at least look at Gurley. But it's worth highlighting, a forensic pathologist with the ME's office testified that given the wound, the bullet tore through Gurley's heart, CPR would not have helped.
What's next in the case?
The prosecution rested shortly after lunch, and the defense called 3 witnesses, all other police officers. 2 of them testified to seeing Leung distraught and crying after the shooting. They also talked about riding to the hospital with Leung. Officers are routinely transported to the hospital after they fire their weapons. And one said that paramedics gave Leung oxygen because he was hyperventilating. The trial resumes Friday, and all indications are Officer Leung himself is going to testify on Monday, with jury deliberations expected to start Tuesday.
Thanks, Robert Lewis.
You're welcome.
New York, New York.
Today marks the anniversary of what is considered the largest civil rights protest in U.S. history, and it happened here in New York City. On February 3, 1964, students took part in a one-day boycott to call out the separate and unequal conditions of the city schools. WNYC's Yasmin Khan takes us back to that day and to the unfinished business of school integration.
460,000 students didn't go to school. Even adjusting for the usual absentee rate, it was quite an organizational feat to have that many empty desks. Television news footage of that day shows teenagers chanting, "Jim Crow must go," in front of the Board of Education building on Livingston Street. There's a heavy police presence. Some of the adults taking part get arrested, like this woman, who's white. She's angry at education officials.
In 1954, the Supreme Court said the segregated schools are illegal, but they still have them. They're violating the laws. We're not.
School segregation had been illegal in New York for decades before the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education case. But housing segregation kept the schools racially segregated and blatantly unequal. Schools that served mostly minority students had less experienced teachers, inferior facilities, and even shorter school days because of severe overcrowding. These are stubborn issues that we've allowed to linger in the school system today, despite the fact that kids fought to change things more than 50 years ago. One black teenager on the picket line in 1964 calmly explained his demands this way.
All we want is equal education. That's all. Equal education.
The activist Milton Galamison organized this day. He was pastor of Siloam Presbyterian Church in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Besides calling for desegregation and improved schools, he wanted the protest to call attention to what activists called vague promises by the Board of Education to improve things. Here's Galamison on the day of the boycott, interviewed by ABC.
Nobody can do these children more harm than these children are being done every day in this public school system.
He'd been criticized for calling on parents to keep their children home from school in the name of improving education.
And in my opinion, the refusal of the board to already have taken immediate steps to correct these evils is a disgrace and a crime.
But members of the Board of Education did have plans.
New York's television and radio stations now present a special report from the Board of Education. The board today presents its plans for better education through integration.
Every member. In fact, just days before the boycott, members of the board presented a 3-year blueprint to racially balance some schools. They had charts and an itemized action plan.
School-by-school review of all existing zone lines. Re-emphasis.
That's James Donovan speaking. He was president of the board. The plan included better integrating school staff and busing some students short distances.
The plan that we have presented for the promotion of integration is tangible evidence of the belief.
The board was trying to prove it had integration on the front burner, but city officials had been speaking with a moral urgency and making plans for years already. It formed a commission on integration in 1955. It had subcommissions, public hearings, and final reports and recommendations well before the school boycott.
Northern politicians and Northern school board members were great at talking about the importance of integration. They were much less good at having the political will to actually make sure that people went along with those decisions.
This is Matt Delmont, associate professor of history at Arizona State University. He says the number of segregated schools in New York actually quadrupled between 1954 and 1964. In part due to changing demographics in the city, but also because the city got a lot of pushback to even small-scale integration plans.
In most cases, what would happen is they would issue the report, and then you would get tremendous protests among white community groups that would encourage the school board to be extremely modest in terms of the actual policies they would advocate on the ground.
Delmont is the author of the forthcoming book, Why Busing Failed. So he's been looking at this exact issue in northern cities. Places where people extolled integration efforts on principle, but when it came to making changes on a neighborhood level, communities, white parents, pushed back. In March of 1964, soon after the school boycott, some 15,000 white mothers had their turn. They marched to City Hall with placards reading, "Busing creates fussing," and "Don't let the courts dictate our children." This was in response to the city's plans to rezone about 20% of the schools that were mostly black and Latino. Here's how an ABC television reporter summarized the event.
The women abandoned their vacuum cleaners and their kitchen sinks to come here and protest against certain Board of Education plans for speeding integration in the city's schools. Their chief complaint, the plan to transfer white students by bus to predominantly Negro schools, some of them in ghetto areas.
Okay, the language is dated here. Women and their vacuums, the term Negro schools. But the message that day in 1964 resonates today. Families wanted to send their kids to their neighborhood school. But Delmont says the neighborhood school concept was never sacrosanct until the issue of school desegregation.
They never said, we don't want to send our kids to school with black children, or we don't want black kids in their schools explicitly, at least not in that protest. What they said is, we're trying to protect our rights as parents and taxpayers.
The city would move forward with some of its integration plans. But to civil rights activists, the plans were never broad or swift enough. Plus, the neighborhood school remained at the heart of school planning. And with housing segregation, almost guaranteed that schools would continue to be segregated. This frustrated activists like Milton Galamison, who organized the February 3rd boycott. Here he is a few years later, speaking on a WNYC radio broadcast.
Every time we brought in a teaspoonful of integration, the Board of Education threw it out by the shovelful. And then the black community got to the point where it felt that it would no longer push for desegregated school systems.
By the late 60s, he shifted priorities. He wanted black communities to have local control to improve the conditions of schools themselves. But it wasn't Galamison's endgame. The demands he and protesters made during that February 3rd boycott were still the goal. Galamison wanted integrated schools.
I have believed, and I continue to believe, and perhaps I will always believe, that the best kind of education for every American child is a racially balanced education where people of different ethnic groups are learning together.
That idea of integration as an educational goal is still up for debate, but it's not one that education officials are leading. If they ever need ideas, though, there are plenty of reports and recommendations written 50 years ago that still apply. For WNYC, I'm Yasmin Khan.
For more of our reporting on integration in New York City schools, or the lack of it, go to schoolbook.org.
Well, 2 years ago, the group Black Youth Project 100 released a public policy agenda called Agenda to Keep Us Safe. The group said it was the cornerstone of its campaign to end what it calls the criminalization of black youth. Yesterday, BYP unveiled a follow-up agenda, this one focusing on economic issues. It's called the Agenda to Build Black Futures, and the group says it's a call to action for everyone committed to black liberation. Janae Bonsu is the National Public Policy Chair for Black Youth Project 100. She joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So this was bubbling up more and more, this new agenda around MLK Day. And a couple of, about a week after, I think it was just last week, we had a young gentleman in talking about something that you pointed out, another legacy of Martin Luther King that doesn't get talked about as much, and that is his Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. And you referenced a quote of him, you know, until our economic needs are met so that we can participate to the fullest extent of our social and political lives, America cannot truly be considered a democratic nation. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, do you find that a lot of young African-Americans are leaning more toward that part of his legacy than what a lot of us see as his legacy?
I think it's more so being done now. I think in the past couple of years, there's been an intentional focus to reclaim MLK's legacy because, you know, it has been whitewashed, and the MLK that we learn about in our textbooks and, you know, who's lifted up during this national holiday is, you know, just focused on desegregation and reform. But, you know, folks don't recognize that King was actually very radical, especially in his last days. And, you know, I think there's been a really intentional push to kind of highlight that legacy.
Yeah, what he said in 1968, we are still struggling now for genuine equality. Much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. And when you look at the numbers, Janae, you know, the unemployment rate is 9.6 among African Americans compared to 4.6 among whites. The poverty rate, 26% compared to 12.7. And just one more stat, median income for African Americans is just over $35,000, $56,000 for Africa for whites. So clearly, your group is on to something here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those figures are really staggering, and we have to be very critical about, you know, the root causes of these conditions, right? And I think, you know, this movement for Black Lives and this movement moment that we're in right now is really imperative. But, you know, what we want to do with the agenda to build Black futures is expand this narrative and recognize that, you know, our conditions and our problems that we face in this country transcends the issue of police violence, you know, in order
to go beyond that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we have to have a more comprehensive platform and vision of goals that we're trying to achieve.
You said the root problems is the issue with police one of those root problems. What are some of the other root problems?
So definitely, so state violence, I think, is multifaceted. So police violence is one form of state violence, but state violence is also economic.
Lack of development, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, we live in a city, Chicago, for example, where resources are distributed very unequally. And so we have 40% of our city budget that goes towards policing, but at the same time, we're closing schools. At the same time, we're closing mental health clinics. At the same time, you know, our schools are underfunded. And so we have to really interrogate, you know, how these things are happening in reverse generations of racist public policy that's gotten us here.
And talk a little bit about some of the things that the agenda calls for. And I'm curious how they differ from a couple of generations before in terms of what civil rights workers, activists were calling for 20, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one thing we call for is reparations and revisiting that conversation. And I think, you know, the word reparations is enough to shut down a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
But I think that stems from a misconception of what reparations actually is. I think, you know, a lot of times reparations is associated with, you know, chattel slavery, which is, you know, legitimate. But, you know, our call for reparations is saying, you know, the way that our conditions in this country can be traced down to, you know, beyond Jim Crow, but, you know, redlining policies, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, you know, and just the perverse criminalization of our bodies, you know, that's harm done. And reparations, by definition, is to make amends for harm done.
And I think when people hear that phrase reparations, aside from the first thing that you just mentioned, I think sometimes what also shuts down the conversation is people, they're confused about how it would unfold, right? Are we talking mm-hmm. about a lump sum, and how do we determine, you know, but it doesn't, from what I've read about the agenda, it doesn't seem to be that. I mean, you could look at it as tax credits. Mm-hmm. You could look at it as a different kind of funding.
Yeah, absolutely. Reparations takes many different forms. And I think that's also another misconception. I'm glad you raised that. It's not just cash. Reparations can be a scholarship fund. Reparations can be land, economic development, you know, like you said, tax credits. It's so many different forms. And actually, I think the agenda to build Black futures is, in its entirety, can be placed in a reparations framework, right? Because other things that we talk about is, you know, closing the race and gender gap, pay gap, you know, a worker's bill of rights, you know, the assertion that every job should be a good job. You know, a good job shouldn't be, you know, the exception. It should be the rule, and really lay out a worker's bill of rights to get at that. Stabilizing development in our communities and, you know, support and protections for trans and gender nonconforming people.
Janae Bansu, she is the public policy chair for Black Youth Project 100. We've been talking about their latest agenda, this one dealing with economics. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing this with us.
Thank you. And if you want to download the full agenda, it's available at www.agendatobuildblackfutures.org.
And we'll put a link to that on our website. Thanks
Thank
a lot,
you.
Janae.
All the reasons why, all the reasons why.
First Friday of the month, which means we get some insight into how the economy's doing. The Labor Department reported that 151,000 jobs were added in January. That's fewer than expected, but at the same time, the unemployment rate fell to an 8-year low. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
Earlier today, President Obama walked into the briefing room to crow somewhat about the economy.
The United States of America right now has the strongest, most durable economy in the world. I know that's still inconvenient for Republican stump speeches as their doom and despair tour plays in New Hampshire, I guess you cannot please everybody.
There was a lot of good news in the report. Hours were up and pay went up, and that hasn't happened in years. But now, come on, with this economy, you were expecting a but, weren't you?
One of the problems is that we continue to have a tale of two economies.
Imara Jones is an economist and writer.
We have an economy that is mostly true for people who are white, have good educations, and are tied to those sectors that are flourishing in the global economy. And then we have the economy of everyone else that has been left out and left behind.
One of the groups left behind? African-Americans. The unemployment rate for African-American men is twice what it is for whites, and it actually went up last month. Lowell Blackman is 20 years old. He's working to get a GED, and he's looking for a job.
Right now, any type of job that, you know, that can pay me, I'm good with my hands, so I like to work a lot. Because they got a lot of jobs out here. You just got to have your stuff and be able to do it.
Valerie Johnson is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. She says part of the reason that the unemployment rate for blacks went from 8.3% to 8.8% is because more blacks were looking for work.
Perhaps people who were previously unemployed, you know, were encouraged by last month's numbers and are now looking for employment.
And so you think that that 8.8 is a good sign?
I will never call 8.8% unemployment good, but it's moving in the right direction.
Johnson says there is some good news for everyone in this jobs report.
We still maintain that roughly 2-to-1 ratio between black and white unemployment. So that disparity is very persistent, and it's present whether we're in a recession or whether we're in a recovery. It's present at all levels of education. So college graduates have a nearly 2-to-1 unemployment rate ratio.
Gwendolyn Cole is one of the workers headed in the right direction, she hopes. She's been out of a job for 2 years, but now she's got an interview with the utility company, Pepco.
So I'm so happy about it because I did 15 years with D.C. Public Schools, and then I turned around and did 15 years as a home child provider. So I went into electronics, and it's a wonderful field because it's more data entry, customer service.
Cole's work history shows why many African Americans are struggling to make their way out of the last recession, says Imara Jones.
African Americans are more likely to be teachers and firefighters and police than their white counterparts, in part because of the strong anti-discrimination laws that exist for government jobs that you don't have in the private sector.
Jones says there is still a lot of good news, but a lot of people, especially African Americans, aren't feeling it yet.
Once you have labor force participation going up, unemployment coming down, wages going up, and hours going up, that's the sign of a recovery. But we're not there yet.
But all the economists say we're getting closer.
Damn you, Obama.
One little step at a time. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
The American Civil Liberties Union looked into the notion that driving while black is a crime. And they found that in some states, it kind of is. In fact, they looked specifically at Florida, and some of the numbers that they found was pretty shocking. Now, not only did they specifically look at Florida, they also specifically looked at a certain citation, getting a ticket for not wearing your seatbelt. They found that white individuals and black individuals do not wear their seatbelts at very similar rates. However, black drivers are twice as likely to get a citation for not wearing a seatbelt.
Of course.
So let me give you the data. Police in Florida were nearly twice as likely in 2014 to stop and ticket black drivers for seatbelt violations. And that may be an underestimate since at least one county with a history of racial disparities in seatbelt citations stopped reporting its stats altogether. Okay? So please keep that caveat in mind because it's important. With that said, let's look at the hard numbers. They found 91.5% of white drivers wear their seatbelts. On the other hand, 85.8% of black drivers wear their seatbelts. So black drivers are a little less likely to wear their seatbelts. But it still doesn't justify the fact that they're twice as likely to get a citation for not wearing their seatbelt.
This is a really interesting study because we are told by racists, but oftentimes they don't think they are racist. They say, well, blacks are more likely to commit crime. Right? No, blacks are more likely to get arrested. right? And so this is a great example of it, because some of those guys are like, well, blacks are naturally violent. We enslaved them for hundreds of years, beat them, raped them, killed them, but they're violent, right? Okay, all right, anyway, let's get past that and say, but today they're more likely to. But this has nothing to do with violence. It's a seatbelt. In fact, I would imagine right-wingers would argue, freedom. If you want to put on your seatbelt, you put it on. If you don't want to put it on, then don't put it on, yeah. Right? So you should be in favor of that. So it has nothing to do with criminality, violence. It has nothing to do with anything, right? So, and it turns out it's almost no difference between the races. But when the cops pull you over and go, oh, okay, yeah, seatbelts. If it's a white guy, they don't go, got you. They go, yeah, okay, you're free to go. Okay, if it's a black guy, twice as likely to go, all right, I'm writing you up. And now they got to go pay that. All of a sudden, that's a tax on black people that white people don't have to pay.
Yeah.
So now if you have that white privilege, you never know it because you never got that tax.
Yes. So again, this is another example of white privilege that people, for one reason or another, don't want to accept exists. This exists, right? Again, it doesn't mean that you as a white person didn't achieve great things in your life or didn't do things on your own.
Or that you had it easy.
Or that you had it easy. There are lots of white people who had hard lives and they managed to do great things despite that.
You just don't know how hard it is for the other guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So, yeah, you have a tough time getting a job. You weren't born rich, etc. Nobody's taking that away from you, right? A lot of people are in the same situation, and then they get pulled over, and unbeknownst to you, they get ticketed, and they got to pay more money. And sometimes if they don't have the money for it, they get another bill, and it mounts, and then they can't pay it, and then they go, okay, let's arrest them. Because they can't pay a government debt that they owe.
Right. And we're seeing more and more cases of, like, debtor's prison, where people can't pay back the government for these types of citations, and then they get sent to jail as a result of that. So let me give you another stat that I thought was incredible. If black people had been stopped and ticketed for seatbelt violations in proportion to their estimated representation among Florida drivers, they would have received 20,296 fewer seatbelt citations in 2014 alone.
So, okay, think about that. You're right, Anna. I was blown away by that number. In just 1 year, in 2014, okay, they got 20,000 more tickets because they were black instead of white, okay? Now, how is that not a tax? Think about all that money. And so the state, and I don't think they do it on purpose. And this is why, like, again, it's not a matter of blame. It's a matter of how do we all work together to fix it? So I'm sure there's some cops who don't like black folks or who assume if it's a black person, they're more likely to be dangerous or whatever it is, right? But most of the time, I imagine, they don't even know they're doing it, mm-hmm. right? They just have this thought in the back of their head, oh, no, that guy is like me. That's like, hey, he looks like my Uncle Bob. He looks like my nephew. No, he's all right. I'm like, go home, right? And then this guy doesn't look like me at all. He looks like, I don't know, I'm giving him a ticket. I got to give somebody a ticket. Next thing you know, they're twice as likely to get a ticket. Next thing you know, there's over 20,000 people who have gotten this extra tax put on them. That is so unjust. And then they cut taxes on the rich. Go, it's okay. Let's just give out more tickets. Who are we going to give them to? Black people. And this is one particular case, seatbelt in Florida. But we've covered this over and over again. This is the story in Ferguson where the Justice Department looked at it and they're like, oh, my God. Look at all these civil violations that they give to black people at massively disproportionate rates. And it winds up funding the police department, who then has an incentive to keep taxing black people at disproportionate rates, even though a lot of them are in a socioeconomic condition where they can least afford it.
Yeah.
And they think, who cares? Make sure you don't tax the rich and the powerful and take it out on the most powerless. And that's part of this dynamic as well. If black people not only generally, macro level, are in a socioeconomic position not as good as white people in the country, right? So that makes them a little bit more powerless. But also because of their race, the establishment has rules rigged against them, and then that makes them even more powerless. So when you give them that ticket, it creates a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. They know that they can't fight back. So it makes it even easier and then makes it more likely that they're going to get ticketed.
I know, it's so frustrating. And the worst part about it is the denial that this is existing, that this exists and that we need to do something about it. The denial is what leads to this system continuing year in and year out.
I guarantee you there are going to be a ton of people that watch this video and that will write, oh, yeah, she knew it. Young Turks hate white people. Okay, first of all, I got news for you. Anna is Caucasian.
Okay. People deny that, by the way. Right. They're like, Armenians aren't white, except they're part of the caucus.
Which, by the way, I fucking hate that word. But caucus just sounds terrible.
And we're not talking about the Iowa caucus. We're talking about the caucus.
Yeah.
So that literally makes her caucus. John, Beth, whatever. Of course we don't hate white people. How stupid are you? When we say, hey, listen, it sounds like the system, maybe he doesn't even know it, is discriminating against black people. And we have facts. We have evidence that shows it. Why do you hate white people? No. We're trying to make sure there's justice for everybody. But some people don't want to hear that because they kind of like the system as it is.
I guess so. So much, Huber. New tonight, three UAlbany students claim they were harassed and assaulted early this morning on a CDTA bus. The students are identified only as black women. They say a group of about a dozen white men and women used racial slurs towards them. Albany police say one of the woman was taken to the hospital and treated for minor injuries. The university's president saying in a statement he is, quote, concerned, saddened, and angry about the incident. Police are looking into whether this was a hate crime. CDTA says they're working to give surveillance video from the bus.
In 1912, Virginia Christian became the only black juvenile woman executed in the state of Virginia. She was sent to the electric chair the day after her 17th birthday for murdering her white employer. Virginia's story is the backdrop for a new novel, Forsaken. The book blends fact and fiction and shows how Jim Crow laws affected the teenager's trial. It also features a young, idealistic white journalist who covers Virginia's case, and he tries to help her avoid the chair. Ross Howell, Jr. is the author of Forsaken. He'll be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro tonight at 7 o'clock, but first joins me in the studio. Welcome, Ross. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Tell us more about the real life of Virginia Christian and the case.
Well, not a great deal is known about the girl herself. She lived in poverty. She was in a large family, like many of the black African-Americans who lived in Hampton, Virginia at the time. They'd actually found their freedom coming to Fort Monroe during the American Civil War. She lived in close proximity to not only black families, but lived close by the white family where this murder occurred.
And she was working for that white family.
Yes, she washed clothes. She'd been washing clothes for the family from the time that she was 13 years old. She had been in school really only... the only record we could find that she had been in school was from age 10 to age 13. And for some reason, a reason I could never discover, her mother somehow became paralyzed. And so they had to pull her out of school so that she could work and contribute to the family income.
And how much do we know about the murder itself?
Well,
the killing?
Well, quite a bit. Actually, the coroner's report that appears in the book is taken verbatim from the actual coroner's inquest. And it shows that it was a pretty violent crime scene. The woman was 51 years old. Her health was not good. She was tiny. She was only 5 feet tall and by some reports weighed less than 100 pounds. And she was had been struck, so there was a lot of blood on the scene. And then also she had been pretty brutally strangled, and that's how she suffocated and lost her life.
How did you find this story in the first place?
I came to this story in kind of an unusual way. I grew up in the mountains of Virginia, and in my part of Virginia, there was a legendary story about a shootout in the Hillsville courthouse, which occurred the same year. It occurred just about a week before this murder, and I was doing some research on that. I thought I might, the centennial of that event was coming up. I thought I might write an article about it, and I came across this letter that had been sent by an attorney to the governor of Virginia saying that he had not allowed his client to testify in court because of what had happened. He was afraid there would be an outbreak of violence in that courtroom as it happened in Hillsville. So I was curious about that. I thought, well, you know, maybe this is a way we could say this is another casualty of that shootout. And that was the first time his client was Virginia Christian. That was the first time that I'd ever found her name. And so I started doing the research. And the more I learned about this story, the more I just found myself unable to turn away.
Of course, one of the most significant factors is she really shouldn't have been brought to trial as an adult in the first place, right?
That's absolutely correct. In the Virginia Constitution in 1902, no juvenile was even to be incarcerated, much less to face the death penalty. But the stipulation was that such a youth would be put in a juvenile home, not unlike today. And then at some point later, once they had learned a trade, a determination would be made about what would happen next. The problem in Virginia was that unfortunately for black people, for black girls, there was no such institution. And the really unavoidable fact was she was a black person who had taken the life of a white person. And that was sort of the ultimate Jim Crow crime.
Right. And you also make references to the lingering fears that go back nearly a century to the, remember this is 1912, the Nat Turner Rebellion.
Yes. The narrator, Charlie Mears, actually grew up in Southampton County, which is where the Nat Turner insurrection took place. And in the South, it was always a problem of numbers. Black people outnumbered white people. And the insurrection was pretty horrific. More than 50 people, men, women, and children, were killed. It was done brutally. It was done with knives and farm implements because they didn't want to. The insurrectionists did not want to use guns because the reports would warn other plantations of what was happening.
Why did you choose to make this a novel?
I was surprised at the amount of actual historical material that I was able to find. I found a number of photographs that I thought I wouldn't be able to locate. But I have to say, I felt all along that I wanted to be able to bring this girl to life. You know, it's one thing to say that, well, there's a 16-year-old girl sitting in the Richmond Penitentiary, isolated. But her cell was actually in view of the death chamber where she would die. So I have a scene in the book where Charlie comes to try to comfort her. He brings her a little cake that his maid has prepared, and they have a birthday celebration. And so here, if you have this living child, she was a child after all, celebrating her 17th birthday, looking out at the place where she knew she would die the next morning, I felt if I could bring that to life, that somehow that would create an empathy in the reader than if I just did a history where it said, right, well, this unfortunate child was executed, and that was the end of her life.
Right, and of course, for capital murder, you need premeditation, and her argument in this case, I don't think there was an argument or dispute over whether she actually did the killing, was responsible for it, but whether it was premeditated or a form of perhaps self-defense or response to something else that happened.
Yes, she was. The crime scene showed that something had there was a shattered crockery. She said that the widow had thrown the crockery at her and it had broken on her, and it made her angry. And their argument continued from there. There wasn't a question of her action, but yeah, the matter of premeditation was also big. The other big factor is that her age was very important as to whether or not she was a juvenile. And her defense attorneys did a good job of showing, they found her actual school records, which showed that she had been born in 1895, and these records were created four years before the crime, so there was no reason to try to fabricate this. Right. But still, again, I think the Jim Crow the fist of Jim Crow just crushed any hope she had.
And that's certainly where the injustice is evident, both in her age and the fact that this was not a capital crime, or pretty good evidence that it wasn't a capital crime. Mm-hmm. But so, and tell us more about the defense attorney also, I think, plays an important role in this story and, again, illuminates some of the complexities of this period.
It was really, I had done a lot of research, and it was really when I came across the historical character, George Washington Fields, that I knew I had to tell his story. He escaped. He was a slave in Hanover County, Virginia. He escaped with his family. He was about 8 years old at that time. He escaped with his family on a skirmish along the lines, got behind federal lines, and like many of African Americans of the time, made his way to Fort Monroe. He would go on to, and at that time, slaves by law in Virginia were forbidden to be taught to read or even to have a book. So it was really probably not until he had got to Hampton that he even began to learn to read. He would go on to become the very first African American to graduate from Cornell Law School. He went back to Hampton and started a very successful practice. And then here's where a mystery emerged. In some of the newspaper accounts of the murder and his defense, some of the writers would refer to him as the blind George Washington Fields. And I thought, well, could this be? Well, sure enough, another fascinating thing that happened is I came across an actual relative of his. Her name is Ahena Carson Rogers. She is the senior park ranger at the Maggie L. Walker Historic Site in Richmond, Virginia. And she, of course, does historical reenactments. So I got in touch with her, found out that she had an unpublished autobiography that Fields had written late in his life. And I thought, I'm going to be able to solve this mystery of how he lost his sight. And all that he wrote was, in 1896, I had the great misfortune to lose my eyesight, period. That's all that he said.
So, but he became an attorney and the first graduate, as you say, from that was 1896. He's now a lawyer in 1912. He went to law school without his sight.
Well, this happened after.
After law school.
It was after law school, and he had just gotten married.
I see.
His practice was going along great. And then this happened.
But he continued to practice law.
Yeah.
And you also indicate in this that he has some questions. He is also living under the shadow of Jim Crow. He wants to see justice done, but he has to move cautiously and thoughtfully through this trial.
Here was his dilemma. He had a daughter, Inez, who was about the same age as Virginia Christian. She was a year older, and she was attending Hampton Institute at the time. She was everything that Virginia Christian was not. Virginia Christian was 5 feet tall, stocky, her skin dark as chocolate. Inez was tall, beautiful, intelligent, and she would go on to law school at the University of Massachusetts and come back and practice as an attorney with her father. The great danger for black people in George Fields' position is that here's a professional man. Basically, his goal in life is to remain invisible. In other words, as long as he is active in the black community, as long as nothing happens untoward outside into the white community, his life can be secure, his family can be secure. And so I have it in the novel that because my narrator, Charlie Mears, asked him a question about something that happened in the courtroom. And he said, his response, again, it's a fictional response. Picture this, Charlie. Picture that I had two young black girls, both of them counting on me for their lives. And that was George Fields' dilemma in my mind.
The book, I'm talking today to author Ross Howell Jr. on the state of things, talking about his novel Forsaken. I think you illustrate the complexities of all this beautifully, and using fiction is probably, you know, a great way to go because, again, you're able to sort of flesh out some of these lives. in the book, Charles Mears speaks out against Jim Crow, and eventually that brings him to the attention of the white supremacist group that actually existed. Tell us about the Anglo-Saxon clubs of America.
The Anglo-Saxon clubs were nascent at the time of the trial. One of the founders is an absolutely brilliant man, a man named John Powell from Richmond, Virginia. He was an internationally recognized prodigy as a concert pianist and as a composer. But he was a virulent racist. And he was one of the founding fathers of what was the Anglo-Saxon Clubs of America. It was basically, the way I describe it is, it was a KKK for rich white people. The Anglo-Saxon Clubs actually looked down on the violence of the Klan, what they saw as the secret to what they called themselves the final solution for the Negro problem, was through the science of genetics and eugenics and the law. And so, unfortunately for Charlie, he gets on the radar of these guys, again, these very powerful, moneyed people, and he pays a dear price for it.
Now, what you had, and don't, I don't have too much time left, but you have the option, of course, when you write a novel, of giving everything a happy ending. This ends up, this is a very dark subject matter. It's sad and gloomy in many, many ways for us to think about our history this way and how much it plays a part in today's life. And for Charles Mears, it doesn't end happily either in some ways.
It does not. At least, I don't want to give too much away, but I did want to end the novel on a hopeful note. I do feel that it does end that way. I think hope is something we all need, because I've had people comment on how a lot of the issues that occurred a century ago are so current in our society now. And I think if anybody could take something away from the book, I hope it would be empathy and also resolve to honor human dignity.
And to keep the fight going, my guest, author Ross Howell Jr., his new novel, Forsaken, looks at the real-life case of Virginia Christian, a black juvenile executed in 1912. Ross is going to read tonight at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro at 7 o'clock. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 6th, 2016. So I have been told, first weekend of Black History Month, if that matters to some folks. I know not everybody participates. Compensatory call-in, chime in if you have commentary on things that happened over the last week or so, observations. Certainly we'll get to workplace racism or any of the audio clips that played at the beginning. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We are fundraising for 2016 Invest, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. The blog address is racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, you'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. For folks who are not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested, kept us rolling for it'll be 7 years, 2 weeks from tomorrow, 7 year anniversary. Hope we have helped folks get a better understanding of what white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. That said, 2016 continues. Very somber year thus far. We're still very early in it. The passing at the end of the week of Maurice White of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Certainly, you heard quite a bit of Earth, Wind, and Fire mingled in with the audio clips at the beginning. You can, you know, if you have commentary on that, what he did, what Earth, Wind, and Fire did musically, in my opinion, might be an example of working against racism, white supremacy, counter-racist entertainment effort. Great piece by Jason King at NPR that I posted on my blog, which goes into more detail. We will have Bob Law on the program this coming Wednesday to give his view on what Maurice White was doing, what Earth, Wind, and Fire was doing, just kind of elaborating. He talked about that subject when he was with us last year. I think a lot of folks really enjoyed hearing his commentary. So to get him back to just kind of give us more detail, focusing in specifically on Maurice White, but that'll be coming up on Wednesday. So if you all want to get any commentary in on that today, that's fine. If not, we can make time for it this coming Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Quickly, before I get to some of the folks who dialed in, I got up this morning. I think I've commented before, Melissa Harris Perry, victim of white supremacy. She does have a white parent. Her weekend program on Saturdays and Sundays, I've said, you know, repeatedly, I've watched it regularly. I haven't done so as much of late. They're focused a lot more on the election, and I'm not as interested in that. But even when I did watch it on a regular basis, I always said that, you know, that is a program that Gus T. Renegade is not going to be checking out live very often, because it comes on at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific, and I am not an early riser, so that is just not something that I'm going to be waking up at the crack of dawn to check out what they are talking about, constructive though it may be at times. I was up this morning and was eager to watch Melissa Harris Perry because of what I had seen earlier in the week. They had the Iowa caucus this week. Hillary Clinton eked out a victory for the Democrats. Democratic ring of racism, white supremacy. Ted Cruz got his victory for the Republican wing of white supremacy. But at the caucus, they reported, Melissa Harris Perry, she actually wrote about this on her blog at Wake Forest, and then they talked about it. The Washington Post did a piece on it, posted it on my Facebook page earlier this week, where she talks about being accosted by some race soldier while she was covering the event. And I thought she was going to talk about this on her program today, and I didn't hear, like, a sentence about this at all. I'll give some of the details from the Washington Post report. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can check it out on your own. But she basically says that she was there. It was some white person, or she doesn't even say white, but I think it was a white guy, a white person, a racist. He comes up to her and is, you know, just kind of, she's not alarmed at first. He's just asking questions. Who are you? She says, I'm a professor of political science. This person responds, my wife is a professor of communications, the man said. I think that that is hugely significant, because this was not, I don't think if you have a spouse who's a professor of communications, I don't think that this was some toothless, down-and-out white person, the way that they try to cast racism off and just say that it's poor white people that are ignorant, that don't have any resources, and that, you know, that's just the problem. If we can just get rid of, you know, toothless Jed and the rest of these, you know, dozen hillbillies or so, this problem will be taken care of. That is, you know, total nonsense. But anyway, so she continues. She says things got weird where this person says, what I want to know is how you got credentialed to be on MSNBC. The man said in an abrupt non sequitur. It was at this point that Harris Perry began to get worried. I'm not sure if it is how he spat the word credentialed, or if it is how he took another half step toward me, or if it is how he didn't respond to my question, but the hairs on my arm stood on end. I ignored it, told myself everything was okay. This is a quote from Melissa Harris Perry. Well, it is not exactly a credential, I began. But why you? Why would they pick you? Is what the suspected race soldier responds. So it goes on. I just want you to know why I'm doing this, he then says to her. So at this point, she's thinking, okay, something is, you know, off here. This is incorrect. I don't know what's going down, but this is, you know, clearly incorrect behavior. So she gives some background where she has been a victim of sexual assault. She's talked about this on her program before. She's written about this, lots and lots of detail. She's talked about it. I've heard her repeatedly through the years talk about this. And so she had this was kind of a trigger for her for some of those earlier episodes of sexual trauma and violation that she's experienced. So she's, you know, kind of panicked at this point about, you know, what to do. Does he have a weapon? Is he going to attack me? And so she writes, I freeze. He speaks and moves closer. Is there a knife under his coat, a gun, worse? And I can't hear all the words, but I catch Nazi Germany and I catch rise to power. But I can't move. I'm lulled by a familiar powerlessness, muteness that comes powerfully and unexpectedly. It grips me. Everything is falling away. I'll stop there. She's with some of her students. They see that she's kind of in distress. She moves away. They come in to get space between her and this suspected race soldier, suspected white terrorist. He scampers away. They do alert security, but he's absconded from the scene by the time security is alerted. If I had any platform, if I was ever, particularly at a public event where I'm covering something like this, and some white person, even if it was a non-white person, accosted me in this manner, came up to where I felt this person, you know, may mean me some harm, may have come up to attack me or what have you, that would be the very first thing that we addressed on the program, like, whatever, I don't care when the next time that we come on, that is going to be one of the top things to be discussed. And I don't think she said a word. I had the program on the entire time. Now, I did turn the volume down from time to time because that was why I wanted to watch it. I really had no interest in hearing them talk about, you know, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and, you know, who's the coolest and what we don't like about them and their play. I had no interest in that at all, though it may have some constructive value. That's not why I was tuned into the program. So I had the volume down while they were talking about all that. They did talk about the Flint water crisis, which was interesting. That was, they had a standard segment. In my view, this is a standard practice of white supremacy where they're talking about an event that is explicitly related to racism, white supremacy. The victims are disproportionately black, but the person that they have who is the figurehead for all of this is a weeping white woman, where she's talking about how this has ravaged her family and how they've got to dispose of all these plastic bottles and her children and poor little white babies, and they don't have anything to drink out of the tap, and it's costing them all this money, and wah, wah, wah. When Flint, I've just heard this repeatedly now, disproportionately black city. This is another example of environmental white terrorism. And I have seen this across the board. Democracy Now! Consistently, when they report about this event, even though the very next segment after they had this white woman on, they did have explicit commentary tying this to racism and deliberate acts to erode and deny quality infrastructure, water, roads, sewage, etc. to black residential areas. They did do that. However, in my opinion, it's a standard practice. They did this Democracy Now! When they were talking about the rogue Chicago Police Department and all the terroristic acts that they did. They had a white woman on. They talked to her for 10, 15 minutes, and then they get to the internet. Oh, yeah, they were pretty much exclusively targeting black people. But we thought it's always good to have a weeping white woman on so that you can empathize and feel like this is something really bad. In my view, that's a standard act of white supremacy, white terrorism, and the way that the optics are presented on these acts of white terrorism. At any rate, I say all that to say, I've said before numerous times, Melissa Harris Perry is not the most powerful person
at the Melissa Harris Perry show. I don't know if the white people at MSNBC did not want her to address this, if they already had a schedule of what they wanted her to talk about, topics that they wanted discussed on the program today. Maybe that was the case, but I was really hoping that she was going to talk about that. I was looking forward to playing that segment on the program because I thought that was hugely important. I can even give you the scheduling where it was going to go. I was going to play that and have that segue right in with the Albany incident where the black females were attacked on the bus by the mob of white terrorists up in New York. I was going to plop it in right there, but there was nothing to play. Now, maybe they're going to bring it up tomorrow. They do have a weekend, Saturday, Sunday program, so maybe they'll bring it up tomorrow. If so, I will try to share so that we can listen to it next week. I'm not attributing blame to Melissa Harris Perry for this. The problem is always racist man, racist woman, racist child. As I said, I'm sure some white people in charge could have easily said, we're not going to talk about that. But I do think that that was very important this week. I'm glad that she wrote about it. I'm glad it got shared on some other outlets. I hope people check out the incident. But I was very bummed to be up at 7 a.m. Watching 2 hours of her telecast and not a peep on her being accosted at the Iowa caucus mere days ago. With that, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. The number again, 641-715-3640. Decode 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate for the Saturday program. No metaphors, please. No metaphors. I know people, they can be instructive, informative in sharing ideas, not just about racism, but as I've said, people really, really at times just, in my view, are spreading confusion. They're comparing things that are not similar. And sometimes it's just not providing explicit clarity in terms of what we are supposed to be talking about so that people get no confusion, no ambiguity about what is being expressed, myself included. I think we can all improve on not being so dependent on metaphors to articulate our views, suggestions on white supremacy, counter-racism. If you could go one time with your thoughts, observations, suggestions, and then allow other people to speak, that would be great. We should have time if you have additional commentary that you want to get in, but if you could share one time, that would be great, and just watch the background noise. Thank you kindly. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Just had a couple of observations from the show, and I had some observations I made myself. The Akai Gurley trial. Ironically, yesterday, two cops were shot in the Bronx doing the same thing. The staircase up and down. So I expect that to be in the mind of the jurors, how dangerous this job is, and this could have been him. So I expect him to get off. The last clip that you played where they described the black girl as compared to the white girl, I mean, wow, that was just so vivid. You know, she was short, stumpy, skin was dark compared to this white girl who was tall and glamorous. It was just, disgusting. I'd like to send a rest in peace to Dr. Delbert Blair, who made his transition this week. I knew he was sick around the time when Dr. Welding transitioned, and I just wanted to send a rest in peace to him. What I wanted to talk about was the Zika virus, spread by white people made genetically modified mosquitoes. You had a clip where they were talking about genetically modifying people, but they have already genetically modified mosquitoes. Put it in the largest slave colony in the world, and the second largest black place to Africa, and it's being used as a biological weapon. In my opinion, the reason why I'm mentioning it is because it's starting to sound a lot like AIDS, because now they're saying it could be sexually transmitted or intravenously transmitted, and this is even worse because it could be transmitted by saliva, and for some reason, it got me thinking, at the same time, they're promoting mass marijuana use. So you need to watch who you smoke with, because you know, they got this stuff here that's passed by saliva, and I'm sure it could be passed that way as well. Also, I wanted to mention Cam Newton dabbing in the end zone. I wanted to say that I think football is a very racist sport. I think it's surpassing baseball as the most racist sport. There's no black majority owners. That's the first reason why I say that. And second, because they force all the teams to have to interview the black coaches. I mean, I can't think of another job where they force you to have to interview black people. Third, in a mostly black league. Second in percentage to the NBA, but they have actually more black bodies. And it's also the most dangerous sport. It's the only legit job in America that your money's not guaranteed. And as for the black quarterback, a rarity in football. I played high school football. When the quarterbacks were recruited by colleges, they were forced to switch positions, so they couldn't play quarterback in major colleges. And this is in the 90s. You know, it's very few black franchise quarterbacks in the NFL today. Usually told that quarterback was in the man's position, not like the other positions, which were athletic.
Your line is echoing a little bit. Your line is echoing a little bit. It just started when you were talking about how they made the black quarterback switch. I don't know if it's I don't know if you want to try it again, but it just started.
Yeah, I think it's because where I'm sitting at. But can you hear me better now?
Much better.
Oh, thank you. I was saying you know, they said that it was a thinking man's position as opposed to the other positions where the speed, the size, the strength positions. And here we are at the 50th Super Bowl, 50th year that the two leagues merged. And I say, I mean, I'm sure the firefighter from Florida is better at this, but, I mean, I could say there's been 10, maybe roughly 10 black star franchise quarterbacks over the last 50 years, including Russell Wilson and Cam Newton, who were the last two in the last three Super Bowls, actually. And here all week they're talking about how Cam Newton celebrates touchdowns and how he upset this white lady and her white kid. And but if you think about it, this dude Aaron Rodgers, a white quarterback, he made millions of dollars doing this discount double check dance. And same week that we're talking about Cam Newton's dancing, you find out that Peyton Manning, the so-called greatest quarterback ever, is taking the same drug that Barry Bonds was taking. Put a disclaimer and an asterisk next to his name that he was on steroids while his stats are, like, no good. And Peyton also works out with his brother Eli, so I'm sure that he has knowledge of or probably uses the same thing. Last year we had the heroic white quarterback caught cheating, deflating the balls, and not to mention the other multi-championship white quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, with his four sexual charges since college. This kid is not gotten in any trouble, and he's treated like, you know, he can't celebrate after he scores a touchdown. Like, that's the easiest thing in the world to do. And I just felt like that's a huge act of racism in that sport, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, everyone. Speaking of football, I have been observing the interviews of the quarterback of the Carolina Panthers, which is not nothing new as far as interviewing, and someone has to be a central figure. And normally when the black person is put in that position, if you look at through Super Bowl history, starting from Super Bowl I, with Fred Williamson being the quote-unquote bad guy, all the black males who have been the featured media has been actually on the side of negativity. Like I said, the first Super Bowl, Fred Williamson, there was a guy who was in the same college that I went to. He had left at the time I was coming in, by the name of Thomas Hollywood Henson. went to Langston University during that time, and that was something like the mid-70s. Even before then, Dwayne Thomas. I don't know if anybody remember Dwayne Thomas, Dallas Cowboys. And it goes on and on and on as far as that concern. Cam Newton just happened to be the recent subject as far as trash non-white black people on a global level, because, I mean, the Super Bowl is actually the international attention getter as far as media is concerned. It's more media than the game. It's like the main thing that's being pushed is the global power of racism, white supremacy. Oh, and by the way, we'll take time out in an hour and a half, 2 hours for a football game. That's basically what it is, as far as that's concerned. And the process of getting to that level is tough enough as it is. And then, from a standpoint, especially black males are concerned, it's difficult to navigate through that process. I myself, I'm still a high school football coach, been one since 1981, and coached a lot of guys who actually are presently playing on that level right now. That's basically some of the history. Oh, as opposed to the white males, you have people like Paul Hornick, who is in the NFL Hall of Fame, but he was in a horrendous gambling scandal. But white males, primarily who was exclusively sports reporters during that time, had like a hands-off to a lot of personal things that would take place. Because in that time, there wasn't that many black males in professional sports, period, let alone talking about professional football during that time. He had a lot of issues that would certainly be notable. The player of the day in the first Super Bowl was drunk the night before. Matter of fact, he had a hangover. But anyway, I don't want to make it a case about me talking about football. I'm just trying to let everyone know the contrast of how white males are kind of like, you know, patted on the back of me saying, oh, he's just a playboy type of guy, you know, and it is acceptable. And when it comes to a black male, no matter what their background is, they would give some kind of negative view towards that person. I appreciate the musical interludes. Maurice White, who was actually the founder, and wrote probably most of the songs that the great group Earth, Wind & Fire put on. I posted on the website on how they helped me get through high school and get through college. And I mentioned that, some of my favorite songs, and the songs were based on, they had something to say. It was nice melody in the background, but the lyrics, you know, you paid attention to them because they had something to say. I mean, real crafty and real scientific on how Maurice White was in his lyrics. My favorite song was Devotion, but you're talking about keep your head to the sky. I've heard that during that time that you were playing it, Mighty Mighty, Yearning, Learning, kudos to Mr. White and survivors and his family. He helped a lot of us. he helped a lot of us through a lot of different things. As far as kicking our spirits up and whatnot. And last but not least, I would say that he hit Mr. Fuller's meaning for the word music, Mr. White's music certainly fits in that category, meaning that what you're listening to helps you or aids you into doing something or saying something constructive. His sound certainly fit into that category. And thank you for listening.
All the other folks that have not commented, feel free. Incidentally, we will be on tomorrow. As I said, we'll be rebroadcasting Dr. Welsing. She did multiple visits that happened to coincide with the Super Bowl. So we will be on tomorrow live for the big ball game. So that will be another one. I'm sure there will be lots of commentary tomorrow on football and all the antics that go on tomorrow. So that'll be another one. We'll have ample time to talk about all that tomorrow. Anybody that we have not heard from, feel free to chime in. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Good evening, Cal, and good evening, Gus. Thank you for playing those clips. I appreciate that. And Maurice White, appreciate that, too. The main thing that I can remember from the clips is the author of that book that's about to come out. That's gonna be a horribly racist white supremacist book, but I'm gonna read it. You know, the young lady that, I mean, she had to kill him, you know, I'm sure he was trying to rape her or whatever. The usual treatment that young black women get from white men back then and now, to be honest, but he described her, but he didn't say she was ugly. He never said that. He said they were different, and he went to a Welsing moment when he said her skin was as dark as chocolate, and then when he started talking about the white girl, he did say beautiful, but I mean, we have to watch out for that, because you wouldn't really be thinking, you know, because he didn't say she was ugly, but when he compared her to the white girl, you can tell that's exactly what he was saying without even saying it. So just the sneakiness of the racist white supremacists with their word usage. And there were some other things, but I can't think of them right now. But I did want to ask you about Mr. Gus, when I first started listening to Cal's, you had another option, a podcast. And they had a black man that he had got lynched, and you had the Confederate flag behind it, and that had an episode of Mr. Newey Fuller Jr. He was talking about power, and that was important, and I used to listen to it all the time. For some reason, I must have deleted that podcast. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I suspect that's a topic he might have addressed more than once, but I know he did talk about that when he was on the program in 2012, if memory is correct, summer of 2012, I think July specifically 2012. And I think that at that time the logo that we had up for the cows was the image of Frederick Jermaine Carter, who was suspiciously found hanging from a tree in Mississippi at the end of 2010. I think that could be the program, even though that subject he might have addressed on more than one visit to the program. But I think that might be the one that you're talking about. Oh, and just to make sure that the incident that you all are talking about, the book Forsaken, Virginia Christian, the black female, black girl, she was a child at the time, she killed a white woman, not a white man, so it was not a white man trying to rape her situation. The author, he's saying that from the evidence and from her own testimony that this white woman allegedly threw something at her, physically assaulted her, and she was responding in self-defense and killed this white woman, but it was not a white man that she ended up being killed for defending herself. But yeah, if you drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, I should be able to link you to the program that I think you could be talking about. I might be wrong, but I think that might be the one that you're talking about.
Is it that you took that logo down, or was it you just used the cows now, or...
We used that logo. I still have it. I'm not opposed to it. It wasn't I didn't change my view on it. It's just we got new artwork. You know, people have made different designs for us through the years. So I changed the logo from time to time, and we got a new logo. So I just rotated it out. Plus, when we switched podcast feeds, I wanted to make it clear that this was the new feed. So I put up a new image just so that it would cut down on confusion, so people wouldn't see the same logo and get confused about the new feed and where the current programs would be posted. But it wasn't you know, anything great logo. Frederick Jermaine Carter, I think people should know about that incident, what happened there. But yeah, still have it.
Okay, well, that's all I wanted to comment on today.
Right on. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to Gus. Good evening to all of the listeners and callers. Peace to you tonight. I hope everything is going well. I came in, unfortunately, at the end of the clips, so I don't have much to say on them tonight. But earlier this week, I was reading a fascinating book titled The Middle Class Negro in the White Man's World. It was published, if memory serves me correctly, in 1967. It is a study on the school choices of several Southern Black young people and Northern Black young people of the time, to see what influenced their thinking, what kind of community responses they were getting, what kind of careers they had in mind, and so forth. It is a fascinating book, because when you are reading through it, and it's a very short book, it's, I think, under 200 pages, but it is so simply written that you can fly through a page. When you're reading through it, you see statements which you could easily pull out of the book and insert them into a book today, or into any of the clips that got. You've played over the last few years, where young people are talking about where they believe racism is going, where some parents are saying racism is going, and they would fit comfortably. Again, it's a fascinating book. On the heels, actually, of beginning to read that book, I found this interesting video on YouTube, which actually starred Bill Cosby. It was a CBS special on Black America from 1968. It was a 7-part series, but so far as I could tell, only 2 parts are available. One starred Bill Cosby, which is quite interesting because it's about the Black influence on America, which is not reported in textbooks. However, there was another part to this series, which I also watched, and it was actually on it was on polling data which CBS gathered from white and Black people to gauge how they viewed racism and racial progress. I'm not going to spoil it for you if you want to go and watch. shocked you, because it is, it's fascinating. Both of these, when you place them together, coming about at the same time. But there was one set of polling data which they talked about, which really stuck out to me. When asked, Black people said that they felt that racism would be overcome in 50 years, half a century. This was in 1968, and it was after Martin Luther King died, actually. It was during the Poor People's Campaign. So they said 50 years. We're coming up on the 50-year marker, 2018. When CBS asked white people, when did they feel that racism would be overcome? They said within one century. So in about 100 years. We are quite a ways off from 100 years still, but I think most of us would agree that it's unlikely to be resolved by then, let alone by the 50-year marker. I used to be a big football fanatic a long time ago, especially I started kind of getting away from it in my 20s. But hearing all this speak about Cam Newton, I, of course, was privy to a lot of discussion at work over the last week. One young lady in particular, she was very angry about Cam Newton. This is a white girl, about 21 years old, who openly admits that she dances, quote, to Black music. But I've never seen her so disgusted in her life that Cam Newton was in the Super Bowl. Never. So, but I was thinking about what I believe Thomas in New York pointed out about football being a racist sport, which I absolutely agree with. And I was thinking about something that Amos Wilson said about people leading institutions and teams and what have you, and then the society using those individuals to say, look, you can be them, but the reality is these individuals usually deal with a greater amount of racism to get to where they are, to the point where they're weakened and they can't do anything that they really would do if they were in their right state of mind. And he said that this was Colin Powell. Of course, he was speaking in the 90s, and he listed a whole bunch of other people. And I look at Cam Newton as that same person. Two more items very quickly. I did not realize that the O.J. Simpson trial television series occurred or started. I didn't realize this, but this past week, I'm thinking maybe 20 white people from my job talked to me about it. And I was very, I did very well. I avoided a lot so I didn't get in trouble. But they were all pretty adamant about how disgusting he is and how he got away with murder and yada, yada, yada. This reminded me of a story very quickly. When I was in eighth grade, and the O.J. Simpson trial was coming to an end, actually, the verdict came down. My school, which was about 85% white, they played the verdict over the announcement system so we all could hear it. I was sitting in a class where I was either the only Black child in there or it was me and one other person. The teacher, of course, started going around the room. People wanted to make their statements. 2-1, every white person thought that he was guilty. It was insane that he didn't go to jail. I was not very talkative back then, so I didn't say much. Actually, I didn't say anything. But my teacher focused on me, knowing that I was a good writer, said to me, we'd love to know what you think about this, because, you know, you are the only Black person in the classroom, and you are very articulate. So what do you think? I, of course, said what I thought. And what I thought from following the evidence was I didn't believe he actually did it. And I laid out my case using evidence why I didn't feel he did it. You would have thought I had advocated digging up the bones of Nicole and throwing her across the freeway. Everybody went crazy. after the class ended, a girl that I actually grew up with, I mean, from kindergarten to that point, came up to me and said, "And I thought you were a good man. I really thought you were a good man." And I got some harassment over the next couple of months for that. And finally, I took the time out of my busy schedule this week to actually watch a movie, which I don't do, but it was kind of bugging me because the title was so interesting. Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, which stars Felisa Rashad from The Cosby Show. Incredible amount of black respect. It was about, the movie itself took place in, I think it was the 1940s to the 1960s. Amazing, amazing, amazing acting and black respect. But not too much on that. Thank you, Gus, for the opportunity. And thank you for the show. I look forward to tomorrow. Peace.
Right on. Appreciate that. I just wanted to get a correction. It's fascinating because two people heard that. At the previous caller didn't mention anything about it. I just wanted to get it in. Metaphors, that was number one. No metaphors. But the correction, the last audio clip that played, it was talking about Virginia Christian, the black girl that was killed in Virginia, sentenced to death after she defended herself against killing the white woman. When they made the comparison at the end, they were talking about the black male lawyer who lost his sight and was trying to help Virginia Christian. The comparison that he was making was his black daughter and Virginia Christian, who is also black. They were not comparing her to a white girl. They were comparing her to a black female who happened to be lighter complexion than Virginia Christian. But I just thought that was interesting that two people heard that and thought that they were comparing her to a white female, but they were not. They were comparing her to a black female. Inez was the black female's name that they were comparing her to. Anywho, folks have other comments that they would like to get in. Feel free. If we have not heard from you, your line should be open. I see other hands up. I'm not sure if they're waiting for workplace racism or if they are not in a quiet spot or not. But we have about 20 minutes before we get to workplace racism. If you have things that you want to get in that you know are not related to workplace racism, you should do so now as opposed to waiting until it's close and then folks dialing in and saying they have something they want to get in before we get to workplace racism.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
I was saddened to hear two to three black females that were attacked on the bus in Albany. Apparently there's video footage that I don't know, I guess the white and Hispanic witnesses do not want to be released, I guess, to protect the perpetrators. But it made me think of how we've always been unsafe in this country as black people, but it's just getting worse and worse. And it's like we can't even travel out in public where, you know, they're mostly, you know, like if we're in the presence of mostly white or Hispanic or Asian people. And so that's just a comment I wanted to make. Thank you.
For sure. I know we have a lot of listeners in New York. I would encourage folks maybe to keep an eye on that case as it proceeds. I know a news report that I saw yesterday, they didn't release the footage, but they said that the enforcement officers in Albany had got some of the footage because this happened on the bus. And so, you know, a lot of public transportation, they have, you know, cameras now. So they said that they did have the footage from the incident, and they reported that it contradicted the story of the black female victims, where they said that the audio, that there were no racial slurs, and that it was, I think the term that they kept using was that it was damaging. It was damaging to the allegations of the black female victims. And I know that there is a pattern, particularly it's for black people on the whole, but it seems like it's especially so if they are black college students, where they will say, oh, they made it up. This is another hoax. I think people have brought up the movie Spinning Into Butter before, where that's kind of the plot of the movie, where this black male student alleges that there are all these acts of racism on this college campus, and it turns out that he's made all this stuff up. But I would encourage folks to kind of keep an eye on that situation, because I would not be surprised if they turn it around and say, oh, they made this up and got us all riled up over nothing, and, you know, they instigated this incident and then lied about it and whatever. I would have played the update, but they didn't have audio to it. At least when I checked yesterday, they didn't have audio. They just had the report. But you can check it out online. But that was reported yesterday, that the video from this is, and I suspect they will release it at some point. I hope that they release it at some point, that the video footage they reported contradicts what the black female victims alleged happened, where they were attacked by these 10-12 suspected race soldiers. Other folks have commentary? Anybody that we have not heard from? If you have commentary, feel free to participate.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers. I just wanted to make a comment on the first female that was executed in the 20th century in the state of Virginia, Virginia Christian. She was a juvenile, and I think that from the sources that I can see, she was a maid and working for a white woman. And the white woman was elderly, and the white woman was abusive, and she had accused Miss Christian of stealing. And so I guess they started arguing, and, you know, from way the reports go, that she admitted to hitting the white woman in the head and eventually killing her. And she died from suffocation because she stuffed the towel down her throat. You know, when she was arrested and they put her on death row, she only spent 5 months there. And, you know, normally you spend years on death row, and you have a chance, you know, to get, I guess, you know, a stay of execution from the governor. You know, none of that was given to her. Her mother wrote a letter to the governor, and based upon the letter, she seems to be not well educated because of the misspelling of the words. But this juvenile was executed 17 years old, and her mother was paralyzed. You know, it's amazing that we did not know of this, you know, before now. At least I didn't, you know, and I'm really big on checking out female that were incarcerated, you know, and I like that show Snapped, that shows the females, and it's disproportionate that the white women, you know, are not prosecuted to the full extent of the law, and then very little evidence is needed to incarcerate a black person or a black female. And as far as the football goes, I am a football fan, and I'm looking forward to Cam Newton becoming a Super Bowl winner. And it plays out that, you know, they say Peyton Manning described him as a legend, but they are describing Cam Newton as a superstar. And basically, I'm looking for something fishy in the game, because if you figure Peyton Manning may be his last year, and he's got these accusations concerning his illegal use of steroids, you know, the fix may be in on the game. I wouldn't put any wages on it, but I wouldn't be surprised if something really weird happens in this game. So I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure. I didn't know about this case with Virginia Christian either, and I'm born in Virginia. I don't remember anybody ever talking about it any of the time that I was in school or relatives or anything like that, which is, you know, standard. So I said I'm a big proponent of studying local history. Where you happen to be at, you should really do some homework, do some digging, and try to find as much as you can, because there tends to be a lot of information. But absolutely, I'm going to see if we can get the author on the program. Even though I'm not a big fan, because he wrote a nonfiction book on this, I'm not a big fan of that type of writing fictional accounts of things that actually happen and changing it around and all this other stuff. But it might be constructive to see if we can get him on the program. It is a white male, suspected racist, who wrote this book, Forsaken. Other folks that we have not heard from who had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Can you hear me now?
That is better.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. First, I wanted to make a comment on it was a audio segment last week, and it had Macklemore, I think that's what his name is, the rapper, on Sway's radio show. And I noticed Sway, he used the term white supremacy. And because I know that term white privilege was being used, and he used the term white supremacy, and he asked the guy, Macklemore, that question that I know I heard Dr. Wilson mention about what do white people talk about when there are no black people around. Like, I don't know if he asked it the same way, but it sounded very similar to it. And he asked him two times, but he very cleverly avoided answering the question, but he just ended up saying, well, you know, this is what we talk about on the album, you know, because like after he asked him the first time, he evaded the question. Then he said, but yeah, you know, because we talk about it, you know, amongst black people, you know, on this show, and you know, there are no white people around, so yeah, we talk about it. So do you ever talk about it? he tried to ask him again, and he wouldn't answer the question. He wouldn't answer. So I caught on to that. Like, I wanted to ask you guys, did you catch that part from that segment?
Man, now calling on my memory. If I recall correctly, I noted the same thing when Sway asked the question, that it did sound similar to Dr. Welsing, the way she phrases the question, what do white people talk about when there are no non-white people around? But the thing that I know, if memory serves, the thing that I noted when he asked it, he said, he was saying basically, what do white people talk about? Do you talk about this with other white people? And he said, or are they ignorant? And I think he said the term ignorant twice before he went to Macklemore to respond. And I think Macklemore in his response, when he said, you know, that they will, I'm paraphrasing, it was something to the effect of they will talk about white privilege, or he might have even said white supremacy at that point, they'll talk about it, but then it stops there. And I think he, Sway, he did go back and give the redirect, but I, just from memory, it's been a week since I listened to it, but from memory, he was, Macklemore, I felt like he was very deliberate in his responses. Like, he struck me as a white person who was taking a lot of care in his choice of words, taking his time, being very deliberate about how he was going to answer questions, not someone who was just free-flowing and, you know, I'm just talking, we're having an earnest conversation. This is my guy, Sway. We hang out, we globetrot and what have you. He sounded like the typical white person who is investing a lot of mental energy to make sure that they say things so that they are not construed, so they do not sound like a white supremacist. But I'd have to go back and listen again to that specific exchange. But I think most of what you're saying, I'm remembering, I think is on point.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I agree with that. And if I could comment on two other things that I think the clip from the Shepherdville, I think that's what it was, the mayor, and that text message of him saying that black people should be injected with syphilis. I guess he was saying that in a general sense to like every black person like that. That sounds like a very terroristic genocide like type of threat. And it reminded me of that teacher that had she said she had a wish, and if she could wish something, she would wish that all black people would die, something like that. Like, that was pretty much on that level. And I'm trying to remember the last one. Oh, the females, the black females that were attacked on the back of the bus. Yeah, I've been noticing that too, about a lot of the articles seem to be putting out confusion. And I noticed when I looked at the first article, the female put on her Twitter account, you know, she was saying that, you know, I guess she was shocked and all of this, and that she was saying that it was people from what I suspect maybe white students were laughing and recording, and pretty much, I guess this may be that metaphor, but doing the Voltron effect, pretty much just being in unison with other white people practicing racism, both males and females assaulting them. And yeah, I just found that very interesting that that they would pretty much try to pretty much twist the story around after all of that. And just one last thing, I've seen this, I think it was a commercial for the, I think the Jesse Owens movie, and the term that they used to call the movie was race, and I thought, you know, like he running a foot race and then the race issue, I thought that was a very interesting title for that movie. And that's all I pretty much have for now.
Absolutely. I said the same thing. I had an audio clip that I didn't play from last week with J.R. Smith. He's a black male. He plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers with LeBron James. Incidentally, J.R. Smith just had this massive article. I want to say that it was in GQ, but I could be incorrect. I posted it on my Facebook page. But anyway, in the article, he was saying that he struggled. Oh, it was a white person was asking him, like, is it difficult when you go to shoot free throws and people are yelling at you and, you know, doing all the crazy stuff that they do? And he says, no, not really. You know, the only time it's difficult is when you're trying to shoot free throws and they're yelling and calling you nigger. I thought that was quite interesting from Mr. Smith. But anyway, last week he took a group of children to see that movie, Race by Jesse Owens. It looked like it was almost all, it might have even been all black children, but he took them to see that movie. Anyway, when they were showing the preview to it, the first thing I noted was it was just swastikas and Nazi paraphernalia everywhere. And I thought, man, I wish Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, wish she was here. But in my view, that is intentional. Yes, that is an important story, and Jesse Owens, that's historically accurate, and, you know, that's maybe it will encourage folks to study more about Nazi Germany, which is what Dr. Francis Cresswell's inconsistently advised. However, I view that white people, any excuse where they can put up blatantly white supremacist symbolism, man, in my view, that hitting the brain computer in this environment where you just had, I won't even use that metaphor, that being promoted, projected, and whites seeing that on a regular basis, where you have that, the film series, Man in the High Castle, where it's this fiction where Nazis won World War II, and you've got Nazi paraphernalia everywhere. They, even to promote this series, they had Nazi paraphernalia all over the subway in New York, and now you have this Jesse Owens movie, and that's another one, Nazi paraphernalia all over as they promote the movie. They know the impact that that has on whites, where you end up having Melissa Harris Perry saying, I was at the Iowa caucus, and a white man comes up to her and says something about Nazi Germany, rise to power, as he's explaining why he's going to do this. She said that in the post where she thought he was coming to accost her. He was coming to do something physically violent to her. They know how that impacts racist man, racist woman. I would even submit that that is how you end up with things happening like with the Albany bus attack. I suspect there's a strong correlation between you just keep putting that up, Donald Trump and all the other things, but white people know how that impacts and encourages white terroristic behavior. At any rate, if anybody had comments they wanted to get in before we get to workplace racism, you should definitely go now before we get to workplace racism. Anybody that we missed, anybody who had a hand up who hasn't spoken at all?
Good evening. It's Karma. May I be heard okay?
Yes, ma'am.
I always worry, just having had some peripheral contact with the CDC, I always worry when there's a new outbreak of anything that they've been busy. So the only things that I could find with the Zika virus, just historically, every once in a while when I'm dreaming and I don't exercise any control, I say, why don't we just bring malaria? Just bring malaria back, because even though it does kill a lot of non-white people, it kills all the white people. I mean, if they're anywhere around with any of these viral infections, they are 100% dead, but it does kill a lot of black people too. And that's the main reason why they really haven't invaded what they call the tropical zones, all of those things between the 33rd parallel. And it's really why they were so late getting to the South. And why they still remain, you know, mostly outnumbered by non-white people in the South. It was all of this, the mosquito-borne illnesses, the malaria. I mean, even though we got sick, it wasn't 100% fatal like it was with them. And I have told you before, the CDC started off as the Office for Malarial Control. And after they finally got it covered and DDT sprayed everywhere and got rid of every mosquito, white people flocked to the South. They stayed in the North before, but they flocked to the South after they finally got rid of most of the mosquito-borne illnesses. And I just think whenever I see a mosquito-borne illness, I always think this is a chance. I mean, this is a chance. They've been bringing back DDT slowly but surely all over the world, starting all of these birth defects and things like that again with the DDT, even though they were supposed to have banned it. And if they could just get that DDT out there, drop tons of it, get rid of all these mosquitoes, it would be such a good habitat for them. So, you know, I don't know. I can't really fathom a mosquito-borne neurological brain deficit. You know, maybe some others, but, you know, rubella, things like that. But it seems so weird. But it does seem okay to me that they would use that, this horrendous, horrendous outcome as a way to go full out, spreading DDT all over the place, get rid of all the mosquitoes in that tropical area, and then move in. I know that it just, I don't know, it's just so unusual for mosquitoes to cause microcephaly like that. It's just, I haven't figured it out yet, but I just know they're up to something. Oh, also, what is the World Health Organization and the banks, same exact areas they're targeting, really poor areas. And they have a six-point plan to end poverty in these really poor areas. And they're telling us the first part of their six-point plan is health. Because, and they're saying, because, you know, people get sick and they'll default on their loans and, you know, and they'll be underwater. And so we're going to institute some new health programs in the exact same geographic areas as the Zika virus. How fascinating. But anyway, it was just me letting my imagination run wild. Thanks for listening.
Right on. Anybody that we missed before we transition to workplace racism? Anyone that has not been able to share at all? Right on. 60 seconds. Anybody, anything that they want to make sure they get in before we transition to workplace racism? 60 seconds.
Yes, I heard someone else. I don't know if I'm allowed to go right now.
Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Okay, 60 seconds. Yeah, just wanted to include, because I stay in probably the most tropical part of this part of the world that is called the United States. I saw in the world news to where this is like target number one. Mosquitoes are almost like pets down here. And you know, everybody I think on the phone knows and understands that when it comes to these type of biological weapons, normally the victims are non-white people. Excuse me. So expect to hear more about the suffering down here in South Florida in the Miami area. That's it.
Right on. That will take us to workplace racism. I do think it is. I'm not into coincidences at all. But for this to happen the same year that the Olympics is going to be in Brazil, with a massive population of black people, as Thomas in New York just pointed out, and now they're saying that they think this can be spread sexually. I do not think that is a coincidence at all, but I'm sure that will be something we can discuss and study more as the weeks continue and there's more information about it, but that is definitely something to keep in mind. Workplace racism, the number to dial, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you have commentary on workplace racism, again, one of our listeners, her suggestion was that, or really just encouragement for folks that are listening in, because I know sometimes people are unwilling to comment on workplace racism for, I suspect, a variety of reasons, but really emphasize that it is very helpful for her, particularly for her as a younger person, and I suspect other younger people and some not-so-old people, just being able to hear different experiences, even if you're able to reflect on times earlier in your work career when you may have been a little bit more confused about racism, and then you can reflect back on what happened, what you did then, and then perhaps what you would do now, having a better understanding of what white supremacy is and how it works. But just to encourage folks to chime in, because it is very constructive, for myself included. I learn a lot, and just patterns. It's so helpful just being able to catalog, hearing different people commenting who are in all over the globe, who are commenting about things that are happening to them, and seeing how consistent these behavior patterns are. And even for people, if you are an entrepreneur, great, because I've insisted, people say that all the time, as though that is a panacea. If you're a black person and you go into business for yourself, you will not have to deal with racism. Nothing could be further from the truth. I wouldn't care what industry it is, what your chosen profession is, you're still going to have to deal with racist man, racist woman, racist child. It'll just come at you in a different form. But definitely encourage folks to chime in. Always good. And if you figured out some things that work well to minimize conflict on the job, we need that, like, head of the class. So you should certainly dial in and share. Folks have commentary on workplace racism, feel free.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Head of the class is a metaphor. Make sure I'm sticking to my own rules. We need that ASAP. If you have things that would help to eliminate or reduce racism, white supremacy on the job. But yes, sir, we can hear you. Proceed.
Yes, this shouldn't take long. You know, a couple of days back, some terrorism was enacted upon me, where I was walking through the hallway of my workplace. My ears and my time and my emotions were hijacked by racists. And then there was a non-white, non-black person there too. So it was two males and myself. All of a sudden we started discussing Hawaii, which, you know, I've been to before for a short period, but they were basically the non-white, non-black male was saying, yeah, there's reverse racism in Hawaii. And yeah, you know, some of the Hawaiians, they might just punch a white person in the face or just beat them up or whatever. And then, of course, the racist suspect, male, he definitely had a lot to say about that. Yeah, you know, they, you know, the native Hawaiians might see you in traffic and just pull off. Or I didn't quite understand what he was saying. I don't know if they were cutting, you know, white people off in traffic, which is, you know, so, you know, horrible, of course. And but the main thing he was saying was, my wife was hired there, and she found out that she was making $10,000 less than the native female Hawaiians that were working there, you know. So I just thought that was interesting. And I'm just sitting there like, you know, oh, really? Wow. You know, just doing little stuff that doesn't, you know, say much. But I was kind of getting angry a little bit, which I shouldn't be. But it's just like, why am I listening to this? I would have liked to have just walked off and just, you know, let them do their own little thing. But, you know, I didn't. That would have looked, you know, they would have had something to say about that, being that they're both supervisors of mine. But that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Wow. I think just adding that point in that these are supervisors and not just people that you could just be, I don't have time for that, and keep it moving. I think racists, they really look forward to those type of opportunities when they can just take your time and energy and talk to you and say anything that they want, any kind of nonsense, particularly when they can promote, as Dorothy Bullitt did a few weeks ago. Oh, man, you know, we don't think racism, white supremacy, is just, you know, white people mistreating you Negroes. We got black supremacy and Hawaiian supremacy. And, oh, man, let me tell you how I was mistreated. Love that sort of thing, just to promote confusion, nonsense, and to waste your time. And as you said, I suspect that was probably a part of their intent to get some enjoyment out of plucking your nerves, forgive the metaphor, to bother you, to waste your time, and to hopefully get you agitated with them, as I said, just talking nonsense about, you know, their experience in Hawaii. I've been to Hawaii myself. I spent months down there, and it is a global system that, in fact, I was super confused, and that still happened to be the dominant conversation, was racism, white supremacy, and white people being in charge. I didn't see any evidence at all that white people were struggling and didn't have any power in that part of the world. No evidence at all. If anything, I saw heard and saw lots of non-white people, so-called Hawaiians, talking and griping about how whites were coming in and taking over, and, you know, same thing, racism, white supremacy. But, yep. Sorry you had to endure that, sir. Other folks who have commentary, racism, white supremacy, or people have questions, or if you, you know, have a way that you would handle that sort of situation, get out of it, that would be great, too. If you have your own comments you want to share, that's fine as well.
Can I be heard, guys?
Yes, sir.
I just had three observations, if I could share them real quick. There was a first one where I was on the second floor, about to go to the first floor of doing my daily route or whatever, and there was this white couple coming out of the courtroom. I guess they were doing some kind of time-sharing thing or whatever, and I'm about to get on the elevator, and, you know, the white couple, they spoke to me. I spoke back, and here comes this black male, okay? And I'm getting onto the elevator, and he gets into a confrontation with the white woman. I guess they were, you know, I guess having sexual relations. I guess they had an offspring together. And, you know, he was talking about how he couldn't get timeshare to see his kid, and he started calling them, both of them, racists. He said, y'all are some racist MFs. And he said it like two more times. Okay, so the white people decided not to get on the elevator. So it was just me and him on there. So he was pretty much quiet. And, you know, we got off on the first floor to where he starts headed toward the exit. So I just told him to have a great day. You know, he spoke back and he said, you too. So that was the first incident. The second one was my supervisor was talking to another black male that's been working there longer than I have. And usually, you know, they like to, well, him primarily like to try to, you know, joke on things about manhood. So the color pink is usually associated with being, I guess, feminine or whatnot. And he sometimes will wear this shirt, you know, my white supervisor, he'll wear like this shirt. And I guess he was using the term that, oh, it's not pink, you know, it's peach or whatever. I guess it's got like some kind of a white and orange like pattern to it. But if you stand away, I guess it may come off looking pink. So a black guy says, oh, I see you got on that pink shirt, you know. And he turns around and he starts heading out the door. And basically he ended up saying, well, you know, I don't see color, you know. Now he used that phrase, I don't see color. And like I'm standing on the other side of him, and I had asked the question, I'm like, so what do you mean you don't see color? And he didn't answer the question, so he's still talking to the other black guy, and he says, well, you know what? You know, I'm from back in the 60s, and he says, well, we didn't have any color TV. You know, and then he starts kind of like, you know, giggling. So I thought that was very profound, like how you said that. Because this is the same guy that recommended that Power Phrases book. So he has a way of using words and terms. And the last incident was when I was going into a certain apartment upstairs, and this white female, you know, this is a Wilson moment. She was eating these chocolate covered, I guess, beans or something like that, espresso beans. And she was asking me if I wanted some. And I said, I wasn't really hungry. And it was her and another black male up there. So, you know, I'm standing by him. And he says, no, you know what? No, don't get anything from her. You know, I guess they like to joke around with each other, saying, you know, don't get anything from her, you know. And then she says, now, when you decide to stop listening to that angel on your shoulder, now, she said that in reference to the black person. Okay, so logically speaking, she's calling herself the devil. So the black guy says, you know, he just nodding his head, and I'm looking back at him. So I turn back and look at her, and she says, yep, I'm the devil or something like that. And, you know, and he says, yes, she is the daughter of Satan. So I pretty much just keep walking on. And I was like, oh, well, okay. You know, I'll see y'all later. And that's pretty much all I had for this week.
Fascinating. Wow. Particularly the white male saying that he doesn't see color. I would submit that is a double entendre. That Latin phrase meaning double meaning. I think whites do that sort of thing all the time, where Dr. Welsing, she would submit they're always thinking and talking about racism, white supremacy, to even say something like that, probably slyly with a grin or what have you. I don't even see any. Even the second one, I think the second one where he comes back and said that he's from the 60s where they didn't have color TV, I suspect.
Yeah.
That's probably one as well. But that is fascinating. That's why I said a lot of times you could just be observing, paying attention to the things that are being said in your environment on the job. It doesn't necessarily have to be that they did something to you. If you're just more observant, or you're paying attention to the words that are being used, things that they're being said, you can learn a lot about whites. And in my opinion, they will reveal that they are not confused about racism, white supremacy. I even submit that it will reveal that this is on their mind constantly, racism, white supremacy, just in the way that they're talking to each other, where they're talking to you, talking about things that are happening in the news and what have you, regular, just being attentive to the way that they use words. Other folks have comments, observations, workplace racism related, feel free to chime in.
Hey, I once had a white woman on the job. This was between the year. I remember the job. I just don't remember what year. But it was between 2008 and 2012.
Your line is breaking up a little bit. Line is breaking up a little bit. Thomas in New York.
You hear me better now?
Give us another sentence.
How about now?
Sounds clear so far.
Okay. I once had, between the years of 2008 and 2012, I was working at a job. And a white woman told me not to go to Hawaii.
Starting to break up again?
Can you hear me?
Give us another sentence. Let's see.
I was saying I once had a job, and the lady was telling me, white lady told me that how racist it was in Hawaii. And how her trip was, ruined because the people were so racist against us. And, she was talking to another white woman at the time. She recommended that she'll go to the Caribbean. She'll never go back to Hawaii because, they don't know how to treat tourists. And it was just real strange, and she even said it to me, don't go to Hawaii, they're racist. And I wasn't as codified. I would have got in the question lane. I wish I was, but it's funny hearing that from someone else. I'll be my line.
Wow. Fascinating. Fascinating. I have to pay attention to that to hear now if I'm hearing white people talking about that. But, yeah, I would just snicker and ask questions if a white person said that to me about anywhere, Hawaii or anywhere else. But I will definitely pay attention to see if that is a common refrain. I guess folks could even go back. We have had some guests on the program from Hawaii to kind of talk about their experience, residents no less. So you can go back and check that out in the archives. I believe 2009, she was on the program. Other folks who have commentary, workplace racism, observations, or again, if you have figured out some things that work well, always in need of that. Please share.
I would suspect that white people who bring up those type of discussions around non-white black people on the job are kind of looking for some sort of consensus on what kind of range they can have with that that non-white black person as far as discussion how better that it can manipulate in a negative manner that non-white black person, because first of all, they're lying in the first place, and they have a, in my opinion, have a willful understanding that they're lying, and they just want to kind of like gauge that non-white black person. I've had similar experiences on a job before, and that is primarily will be my opinion about what the white person is attempting to get out of that interaction. Whether you say something or not, it's an answer. It's an answer, so to speak, to a white person when they bring up these discussions and they are allowing you to hear it. They always have an agenda, is what I'm saying. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I even had a white female on the job, and I wasn't even talking to her, and she brought up some idea that she was raped by a black male. And I just looked at her and say, "And?" that was at one point in time kind of I guess it's not a metaphor, kind of brash in my approach to white people that I didn't have to have any attention to at all, and because I didn't trust them anyway. Even the ones that did have some sort of rank. But when they would come up to me with a discussion that has nothing to do with a job, then that kind of like gives the open room to interject things that I think that should be said to white people. I would do it at that time since they brought the subject up. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for people on jobs, especially a young non-white black person. It was just some particular points and times where that was accessible to me to do.
If President Obama is listening, might not be advisable for you to follow that advice. I'm sure some of our other listeners might not be the best strategy for you to employ either. But
right.
Yeah, I can say that for one of our listeners that I spoke to. We were talking about workplace racism specifically hours before we went live today. I think that's something too, kind of gauging your environment in terms of what you have the ability to do. I guess number one, what you're comfortable doing. I think everybody, we all have different skills. We all have different strengths in terms of what we feel we can do successfully in terms of using words to deal with white people to counter racism, particularly in the job. So you kind of make an assessment of what your strengths are and what you're comfortable doing on the job, which things that you think you can do well where it's not going to cause you problems. And then I think, too, making an assessment with regards to every particular workplace. I think most of us understand some workplace situations you have greater power, greater ability to do things than other, whether it's you're in a situation where you don't need this job as much, whether it's a situation where you know this is a temporary thing, you're not going to be there, you have no intention of being there long term, you don't need this for a reference, or if this is a situation where you intend to be there long term, if a situation where you've been there long enough where you have a bit more freedom to do and say things, I think it's very important to kind of gauge that to your specific situation to figure out when you have the leeway to say more, to do more, or when you might be in a situation where you are not able to say as much, when you're not able to do as much. Kind of the previous caller that was talking about, it was a white, or I think he's two white supervisors, not just one, but two white people who have a lot of power on your job coming and talking to you. That might be a situation where you don't have
as many options. You don't have as much ability in terms of how you respond to just say something or do something that you maybe would consider doing if these were less powerful whites. So I think that's definitely something to keep in mind and to kind of process that and to kind of try to process that early on the job so that you're already thinking in terms of what your range of responses are on this particular job and with regards to the specific whites that you're going to be coming in contact with on the job. I definitely think that's something that would be good to consider before you go into the workplace situation.
Yes, that I think that's going to take good assessment of what position you're in and where you're at. What was unique about the fire department was within the workplace, you have a television set, you have a living room area, you have newspapers, books that doesn't have anything to do with the fire service at all, and it is commonplace for conversation to be alive and well in that type of environment. So it gives, especially after you have been on a certain number of years, it gives a lot more flexibility. And the closest thing that it reminds me of that I think some people can identify with over the phone is the movie that Denzel Washington played in, where he was on a nuclear sub in the second in charge. I forgot the name of the movie, but the scene was around the dinner table, and he was asked a direct question about something political. and he gave a rather sharp answer to the question as being tossed around the table to each person. That's something that's normal in that type of employment. But as I mentioned before, it's not really recommended in a lot of places that I'm hearing on the phone. You have to be a lot more cautious in what's going on. Much more intimidating environment in certain cases, yes.
Hello. Yes, ma'am, we can hear you, just your volume is very low. If you could raise your voice.
Is this better?
A tad, lots of black self-respect.
Oh, thank you. I once had a summer job when I was much younger, and it was at I won't say where it was exactly, but anyway, there was an incident where it was in a retail environment, and so one of the workers, who was another black female, had asked, in the presence of some other colleagues and the manager, who was an older white female, the black female asked the manager, do you think I'm dark-skinned? Am I too dark? What color do you think I am? And so, and she also said, and I'm not that black, or something to that effect. And so, the white female manager's response was, you're black enough. And then she realized what she said, and then she turned around and said, oh, well, you're caramel color. And then there was another incident where I believe the white female manager was looking for a cup or mug to drink some coffee out of. And most of the staff was like black or Hispanic, Asian, but mostly black. And so the same white female manager said, well, I don't know what the ancestry of these cups are, but I'm going to wash them out. So those are just some incidents I have. Thanks.
Wow, the tackiness abounds. The tackiness abounds. Like,
Again, just paying attention to the way words are used in the workplace. That alone, in my view, if you're less confused, should do a lot in terms of your conclusion about how confused white people are about racism, white supremacy, if they're ignorant, if they don't understand, right? They don't know what any of this is. They don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? Racism? What? Just paying attention to the way that they're talking about it. That, to me, both of those remarks, as well as some of the other things that people have shared, I don't see color, to me, sounds like they are extremely aware and are even looking for an opportunity to make some sort of snide remark to a black person in the workplace, and particularly if they can do it in a manner that, hey, I wasn't even talking about, I was just talking about the coffee cups, you know. I was just talking about, you know, my shirt here and whatever else. And the first remark, that's just unfortunate, that black self-respect is how I started at, for the white person to take advantage of a person who has been intensely victimized, for them to come in and make a comment like that, that you're black enough, and then try to clean it up, or I won't say clean it up, but to try to come in and recalibrate and say, oh, well, you're caramel or this, that, or the other. Just looking for the opportunity to bully and make those sort of remarks. That might even be another example. The retired firefighter in Florida, where he said that they are kind of looking to gauge how much they can get away with saying around you. How confused is this person? Is this person going to push back? Are they going to say anything? Where is their black self-respect at? I think that's pretty typical with whites that I have been around, where they're going to try to make some sort of comment like that and just see how much they can abuse and terrorize you. And hey, if this person is not going to say anything, we can just joke all day long and have all of our fun at this person's expense. But I am sure a lot of us can remember comments like that, statements like that, moments like that in our work history, our history with white people, period, but particularly in our work history, if we just reflect back on things that we've been through. Appreciate you sharing, ma'am. Sure. Other folks have commentary they want to get in, winding things up, workplace racism. If you have comments you want to make sure you get in, do so now. We're almost at the end.
I do have another example. It seems like we have a little time here. So this week also, I was speaking with the young racist suspect, male. We were just talking in general, and, you know, just another example, you know, a couple of things, what the lady that just called spoke, and what the firefighter from Florida was speaking of. He was talking about a training environment that he was in previously, and I guess he was standing in with a group of people, and someone accused someone of saying nigger that was close to his group. So, of course, the guy that I was speaking to, he's telling me this story. He was saying, you know, one of the supervisors or whatever, some huge black guy. And this is another thing I noticed with white people. And they do this on the workplace. They do this in general. They always exaggerate size and just of black people. So if you're, you know, 5'10 or 6'1, they say you're 6'5 and you're 300 pounds or whatever. But this big, huge black guy who's the supervisor grabbed him and another white male and grabbed them into the office and said, which one of y'all said nigger? And now when the white person is telling me the story, he said N-word, and then he kind of mumbled like, which one of y'all said nigger? Kind of mumbled. And again, he was pretty much practicing racism, testing me, seeing, because I'm kind of, I don't want to say I'm aloof at work, but, you know, I don't get into... I joke about things, but I definitely don't get into the race stuff. And I think a lot of white people around my workplace, they're always trying to testing me again, gauging you, trying to see, okay, how's this guy going to react? What's his, you know, how much knowledge does he have of racism? Can I piss him off? Or, you know, because You know, you have some black people that will give, what did you say? Did you, what? You know, they're definitely gauging at all times, man, just constantly, constantly bombarding you with racism and trying to see what you're going to do, how you're going to react. Basically, I listened to a story and I was like, oh, okay, wow, that was, you know, yeah, interesting story. And, you know, I got him, got out of his presence and left it at that. But another racist act.
Fascinating. That's one. We've even had white people on the program previously where they've said that sort of incident where even though the white person isn't necessarily the one who said nigger in the story, but it's an opportunity for them to repeat a racist incident where it gives them a free, it gives them an opportunity to say nigger without being indicted as racist, because I'm just retelling what happened before. And basically she was saying that this is a way that white people look to practice racism. It gives them an excuse where they can be justified in saying nigger. But hey, I'm not a racist. I'm just, you know, I'm telling you what happened. That's what he said. He, you know, which one of you all said nigger? And that's exactly what you said, where he kind of mumbled it. Depending on the white person, that might be one where I would, you know, look to do a little counter-racist experimenting, where you can kind of go back at them and say, oh, wow, you know, are you accustomed to saying that? Wow, sounds like you have some practice at saying that, just to kind of see how they respond. Or you can come up with your own responses or even questions. It's always great if you have a question for a white person, if they want to tell you that sort of incident. Even within the anecdote that you just shared about, you know, them, you're a threat, them overestimating your size, your age, your weight. They do this across the board. They did this with Renisha McBride as well, the young teenager who was shot and killed, Ted Wafer, a few years back. It was 2013. But there was a report this week that came out about black people not getting jobs as CEOs, and they were talking about tips, different things that can help you. The metaphor they use, move up the corporate ladder, but they were talking about tips, and they were saying make sure that people know the things that you do and how they are attached to how the company makes money, particularly people that are powerful, that are in charge, making promotion decisions, hiring decisions, knowing your performance and how it's tied to the company making profits. And one of the things that they said was about being aggressive, that generally would be something that works well. Even before they got to that, they said the metaphor stabbing people in the back with a chuckle, but they said, yeah, I have seen where that works for a certain cohort. They didn't say white people specifically, but it's implied because the whole report was about how black people don't get these jobs. Anyway, so they continue and they say being aggressive, but they say, well, you know, that's where it can be difficult for black people, because if you're a black person, you don't want to be too aggressive on the job, because then you get perceived as a threat. And they were talking about this the whole way through, and they were saying that can be a whole other host of problems if you're a black person. Like, oh, he's raising his voice, and, you know, he's talking to us, and oh, my gosh, you know, I'm feeling intimidated by this black person. I have had that happen to me personally with a white person where they went to accuse me, and this was public. This was like in a meeting where I wasn't even present. Went to accuse me, I think it was, of taking a company vehicle and going someplace really, really far, or going someplace I wasn't supposed to be, or something. And I had to go get the mileage, be like, no, you have made an error. You had the wrong place. I documented where I went. I think she said that the place that I went and only was like 30 miles away. It's like, no, it's 100 miles away, and it was a round trip. Fair where I had to go there and come back, and I showed her the mileage, and as opposed to, oh, I was incorrect, it's, oh, well, they misconstrued, and, you know, such and such and such and such, and all this, no, oh, I'm sorry, Gus, I made an error, I didn't mean to falsely accuse you, and I must have got some bad info, no. And then on top of that, after she leaves, she goes to my supervisor, and I think whoever is more powerful, this powerful white person at the company, to say, well, you know, he intimidated me. You know, he came up and had this information and trying to point out that I was incorrect, and I was fearful. And in the process, my supervisor, who happened to be a black person, where he was pointing out, well, were you in error with the information? And she says, yes. He says, oh, okay, so you're saying that you're intimidated by someone just coming up and pointing out that you made an error. And I'm fast forwarding, by the time they got to the end of the conversation, not only was I intimidating and frightening to her, my black supervisor was as well.
And Gus, I've seen how that works the opposite way too. I absolutely agree with you what you just said, because that happens to me. But and if you're not, if they're going to get you on either way, if you're not, they'll say, oh, this person is not assertive enough, or they're not aggressive enough. You know, they're kind of, you know, they don't have what it takes to be, you know, a supervisor, manager, or what it takes to progress in whatever company or whatever workspace that you're in. If you kind of are cautious about, you know.
I think he might have got disconnected. Carl, I thought that was me for a second. But then I'm still on the switchboard. I think he got disconnected. If he rings back in within the next minute or so, I'll get him back on so that he can finish. But, yeah, I think we have had callers before who have expressed exactly what he was articulating, where the system of white supremacy, we're victorious either way. If you come in, you try. Oh, yeah, there we go. Got him back. Victim, let's see, if you put your hand up, it would be easier for me to nab you. That way I don't have to go through the phone lines. The male caller who just dialed in, then I can get you back on the line so you can finish sharing. Let's see if not, I'll just dig through the lines. I was trying to avoid that, but I might have to let's see. Okay, we got you back, sir. Are you with us?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. I was just saying, Gus, I absolutely agree with what you said. I've been accused of that, being aggressive, actually harassing people, and I'm far from that. But I'm saying with these suspected races, you can't win. Like, even if you're very reserved with how you talk, you know, they say you're not assertive enough, you're not aggressive enough, you're not a take charge type of person, and that's not, you know, that's going to keep, you're not vocal enough, so you're not going to, you know, progress and advance in your career, whatever aspect you are. So it's kind of like they get you on either end, you know, they say you're aggressive, or they say you're too reserved and quiet and, you know, not aggressive enough. So they just practice racism on both ends. You know, you can't win. You know, it's a balancing act that you can't pull off, really. And that's how I find with myself anyway. So.
Absolutely. That is the system of white supremacy. I feel like I've heard that about President Obama for 7 years now. Either he's angry black male, or he's a wimp, he's a chump, he's not assertive enough, he's not aggressive enough. He and quite a few other black folks over the last 7 years, but I'm sure a lot of folks can attest to that from our listening audience. I will encourage, if we have black people who are what they call entrepreneurs, you have your own business, definitely chime in, because I strongly assert that does not rescue you from workplace racism. If I'm in error, you can let me know, but I have talked to enough black entrepreneurs where it did not save them from having to deal with white supremacy, and I see enough reports in the news as well that just further corroborate that you're still going to have to deal with racism. It'll just be manifest in a different manner. But if we have listeners where you have your own business and, you know, you're seeing how racism, white supremacy is a problem, or how you have to navigate it as a business owner, definitely chime in. If you want to email, that's great too. UntilJustice@gmail.com. You can drop an email or you can chime in. I think that would be great to share as well. We will be back tomorrow. We will go live right with the game. I think that's been our ritual for the last 5 years or so now, but we'll be live 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 p.m. Pacific. We will have our rebroadcast, Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing, her 2010
visit for the Super Bowl that year, which Peyton Manning also happened to be playing in. Will be grand to go back. Have not heard that program in a while, so it'll be great, I think, to go back and reflect and to see how much of what she had to share at that time is relevant to things that are happening right now, 2016. I'm sure we'll have time as well after the rebroadcast if folks want to share any commentary. I think I always encourage folks, if you are going to watch the festivities tomorrow, to kind of pay attention. There tends to be a lot of racism all the way through. You never know, the halftime thing, Janet Jackson, remember that a few years back? The commercials generally tend to be saturated. I mean, everything about it supports one big whole day to celebrate white supremacy and their bowl game. But we will be here, and folks will have an opportunity to share how everything goes down. We will also be here on Monday. Program I am looking for. We will have not one but two white people on the program, Ned and Constance Sublett. We played an audio clip about their book, The American Slave Coast. It was like the end of 2015 when their book came out. Man, it is fascinating, and it fits so nicely. He even references Ed Baptist. I'm sure he's read it. The Half Has Never Been Told, for people that are following the book club. But it's I won't say it's identical, but I mean very, very similar subject matter. I would say the major differences are basically that his book emphasizes that the enslavement of black people and that slavery period is a breeding industry, and that white people explicitly talked about it as such. And he combs through like the material of Thomas Jefferson and many of these other white terrorists and torturers, how they were specifically talking about it in that manner. Like, man, get you a few of these nigger wenches and make them breed, and we want them producing children about once every 15 months, boom, 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 spitting out, you know, new little niggers, and that's more money, more money, more money, and adding up. Okay, we got this one at 6 months, boom, boom, boom. And the next generation, by the time they're 15, do the same thing, boom, that's more slaves, we can sell them. Huge commodity. He emphasized a lot of the same points that Edward Baptist does, that this was the banking system, is the banking system of white supremacy, black bodies. He emphasizes that over and over and over. Also, one thing that I really appreciate about his book, lots and lots of anecdotes of black people who killed white people, mutinied, rebellion. I mean, it's just tons. Every other page, and the same thing. White people being constantly in a state of fear. Got to make sure this doesn't happen. Got to keep an eye on the niggers. Oh my gosh, Nat Turner, Stono Rebellion, Gabriel Prosser, Denmark Vesey, Haitian Revolution just goes on and on and on and on and on. The revolution down in Louisiana Territory in 1811. Tons of these examples, in my opinion, black self-respect. But he just talks about that over and over and over again. Will be great to have him on the program. I am looking forward to asking him about the sentence that we talked about this past Friday from Edward Baptist in terms of how most people view manhood and resistance when they talk about slavery, and asking him about that. He talks a lot about Andrew Jackson and how they're fascinating. Lots of great material. But as I said, the crux of it is this is a breeding industry, that this was a huge aspect of slavery, the forced rape of black females to produce more capital, enslaved black people for white terrorists. But that should be Monday normal broadcast time. And as I said, we'll be here on Wednesday. Bob Law, black male documentary filmmaker. He has done many radio programs, successful radio programs down through the years. He was with us last year talking about the history of white supremacy in entertainment. He'll be giving his thoughts on the passing of Earth, Wind, and Fire legend Maurice White. That'll be Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I know a lot of folks heard him and really enjoyed him on the program last year, so it'll be great to have him back with us this Wednesday. If you have any questions, gripes, complaints, ideas, commentary, you can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. And just let me know. We'll try and share it on the program if it's something you want to share with the listening audience. Thanks to all the folks who participated. I hope it's been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. We'll be back in a little less than 24 hours. If there are Super Bowl parties and all that madness going on, man, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. You no time is a good time under this system to not be codified and to be engaged in a lot of reckless behavior. If you're going to be driving, passenger, even a pedestrian, number one, buckle up. That was one of the audio clips from the program. Number two, you do not want to be intoxicated under the influence. Race soldiers, they are looking for black people to take some money out of your pocket, to take some time, impound your vehicle, get you in greater confinement. We do not need any unnecessary problems. Certainly, I encourage not being around other whites who are intoxicated, even if it's a Super Bowl party. I really encourage really minimizing being around other non-white people that are under the influence. We already got enough strife as victims of white supremacy. We do not need anything that is going to encourage us to make poor choices. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Remembrance for Maurice White, Dr. Delbert Blair. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.